did it. We're done.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Oh, how come? Welcome to the broadcast. Hi, Julene.
Hello, Peter.
What do they always say here this time of year? Cold enough for you?
Oh, man. It's gonna no, bring it on. Make it colder.
It's warm. Well, it is. It's 5 right now. It's going to go down to 2.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's cold. Baby, it's cold outside. Well, you're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan, something that's been happening here on the Riff for the last 40 years.
Amazing.
This is the longest-running phone-in talk show in radio history.
Amazing.
But it's even only on Sundays, so it doesn't get the props.
Yeah, well, yeah. It gets props, just not, I think it should get more props.
Well, naturally. Me too. If you'd like to email us rather than get on the air at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
You can write us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Short emails, please, mm-hmm. If you'd like any chance that it's going to be read on the air. If they're longer, it's okay, but I'll probably read them tomorrow, or Julene will. We got a Facebook page, Facebook Friends Always Wanted, and there will be a podcast available of this broadcast by noon tomorrow, noon Monday. You know, I only say all this once.
Mm-hmm. Per show?
Per show, which is a mistake because people come and go, right? Some people listen all 2 hours.
The usual talk show format is you do everything at every top of the hour. So you reintroduce the show and start all over again.
Okay, so it's cold. And one of the reasons I brought that up was that I always look at this right-wing website.
Oh, here you go already. There he goes.
And it's all over. You know, they've just got everything about how it's colder here and then. It's like snowed.
The global warming thing?
The anti-global warming
thing. Yeah.
Well, folks, last year tied for the hottest year on record, confirming a long-term warming trend, according to the World Meteorological Organization. And future warming depended on action to cut greenhouse gas emissions. For all these, and this is perfect for the description of these people that deny global warming. All these numbnuts that think that there's no global warming. They say that the first 10 years of the millennium proved to be the hottest decade since records began in the 19th century. The WMO General Secretary said the main signal is that the warming trend continues and is being strengthened year after year. He said the trend, unfortunately, will continue for a number of years, but the amplitude will depend on the amount of greenhouse gases released. It will depend on action taken to minimize the release of greenhouse gases. 2010 was also marked by further melting of Arctic ice and extreme weather events, including Russia's heat wave and devastating floods in Pakistan. Now, as we've said before, that it also can produce a lot more moisture in the atmosphere, which means then so you get these huge snowstorms as well. So, you know, and actually it is global warming, but it's best said is climate change because it allows these people who I don't even understand what in the world their motivation could be.
Well, I think they don't want to drive a smaller car or, you know, it gets in the way of their own personal lives.
Long ago, one of these morons that makes like hundreds of millions of dollars a year lying, this multimillionaire that makes his fortune lying to working people, a lot of who believe right. it. I never understood that.
Which
but anyway,
one?
I'm not even going to name these people anymore.
Yeah.
But he makes the most. And he said they want to take your SUVs away. So he politicized it already, whereas the world, climate scientists, they're mm-hmm. not politicized.
Yeah, why would they have any interest in doing that?
Well, unless you are of this conspiratorial mind, which all these multimillionaire right-wing talk show hosts, that this is what they feed.
They're throwing it out there left and right.
And if you don't, one of the things, it's all conspiracy theories, like all those little movies. Don't name them.
Okay.
Tony, I could see your lips forming. You were gonna name them. People will just go look them up. They internally make sense. Right? I mean, you've looked at them.
And yeah, you go, I've looked at them.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And they shot Kennedy.
They put it together in such a way. Right. Right?
And they were also part of the, what were those guys? Those Knights Templar or whatever they were back in. So, and particularly when it's on film or on video, it goes by so quickly. You have been disconnected from chat, it says here on my screen. Well, what do I
do
now?
How about that?
Yeah. Well, also, the guns continue to blast away across the land of the free and
this
the home
evening,
of the brave.
This evening, here, in Detroit.
Tell us.
There was an armed guy walked into a Detroit police precinct and shot him up. I don't know how many people were...
Four police were shot, and then they shot the gunman and killed him. This was 4:30 this afternoon at the Detroit Police Department's Northwestern District. And the guy just came rushing in with a shotgun with a pistol grip and began shooting cops. One thing I thought was interesting, the first officer shot was a female sergeant. She was hit in the chest, but her bulletproof vest protected her, thankfully. And she was treated and released.
Yeah.
So, in other words, she could have very well have been dead if she didn't have her bulletproof vest on. Yeah. We live in a country where police, even inside the police station, have to wear a bulletproof vest.
Yeah, that's
right. I mean,
right.
Isn't this kind of a commentary, folks? But that's not the only thing that's happened. A number of congressmen have received death threats. Today there was a shootout at, it wasn't a shootout. Yeah, I guess it was a shootout. A guy came into Walmart, started shooting, killed a woman, shot two deputies. They shot him to death.
Where was that?
This was Port Orchard, Washington.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, you can go to Walmart. Can't you just go there and buy your gun and your
Oh, yeah, maybe he was
you
trying
just
it out.
Purchase
yeah.
it there and you don't even have to leave the store.
And
gee whiz.
One of the many stories, because every week, of course, there's probably been about 500 or 600 murders since
the
Tucson.
Arizona
yeah.
mass shooting, mass yeah, murder.
This one from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, the newspaper there in, Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm.
Police seized guns after Los Alamos standoff. High-powered weapons and ammunition were among the items seized from the home of a former Los Alamos National Laboratory physicist who has become increasingly paranoid and outspoken against the lab and the government. Got all this weaponry and 1,000 rounds of ammunition, which, of course, everyone's needed.
Yeah, everyone needs that much, right?
Now, here's one of these items that you might see in as an idea where an armed populace could, in fact, be determinative in a good way. A young man killed Sunday while allegedly trying to rob a retired Detroit police officer was a student at Grosse Pointe South High School. Grosse Pointe is this extraordinarily mm-hmm. wealthy district.
Yeah.
And a player for the school's varsity football team. Demir Hudson, 18, of Grosse Pointe Park, died in the incident. Hudson was shot multiple times, according to the office. Says police said the retired officer, 65, was approached by the armed suspect about 9:20. Said the suspect demanded a personal item, and the retired officer pulled a gun and fired numerous shots, killing the suspect. You say, see, the armed. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's sort of mixed. For one thing, we don't know all the details. But even in things like that, I've never been held up. I've actually, the only time someone tried to hold me up, they tried to hold me up with a knife.
Oh, okay.
And I know you may not believe this, but I just turned on my heel and ran. The guy tried to catch me, but there was no way in the world.
Not many people are in as good of shape as you.
Well, I was glad he wasn't.
Yeah.
But in any event, I was thinking, what if I would, you know, and the anger any of us have about being, how can we best frame it? Being in a situation like that where someone so intrudes into your personal space, like a break-in, the anger and the desire for revenge
fear as
and
well.
Fear
it's
as well,
scary.
Particularly with women.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the idea that if this guy pulled a knife and I would have pulled out my my gun.
Wow.
And shot him multiple times, that would have been within my rights.
Oh, man.
And you could say, well, I protected myself. No telling, this guy might have stabbed me as well.
And
then I would have killed somebody.
It's also the last thing you want to do.
So I wonder, would have just do better saying, what do you want? You want my money? You want my wallet?
Yeah, well, I My friend owns a party store and was held up outside the party store by a couple of guys. And, you know, he described the entire situation. It's absolutely, you don't get over that kind of thing real quick. But he just gave them the money. And they tried to get him to take his pants off. Sorry. He laughs when he tells the story, yeah. Too. Anyway, they took the money and he's okay, you know.
Well, on the other hand, I've known people that have owned stores that have been shut.
Yeah, well, just in Ferndale, as a matter of fact, there was the man who was shot and killed.
Any number of times. Yeah. But, I mean, ultimately, the question is, why do we live in a society like what's gone wrong here? And last week I said, look, gun owners, don't we have some responsibility to the community at large? And doesn't a group which has one of the most irresponsible groups in the country, the National Rifle Association, that wants this proliferation of weapons everywhere, bars, churches, parties, wherever. I mean, don't they have some responsibility to also say that if there are so many people, there's not actually a lot of people going wrong with guns. It's actually relatively few, given the tens of millions of people that own guns. So it's a relative handful. But it's enough. It's enough that so many people are being hurt, and it's a constant. Well, I mean, we take it for granted. I named a few incidents that happened over today.
Yes,
but you go back every week. There's some multiple shooting. You know,
every week.
Yeah.
Mass murder, multiple shooting, and sometimes not just one.
And there's this one company that has sold weaponry to the shooter at Virginia Tech, and also sold a 9mm Glock pistol, two of them, to a graduate student who walked into Northern Illinois University and just started shooting, killed five people and wounded 18. So this guy's got a mail-order gun place, and he's still shooting stuff. Well, here, the contention of those who would like college kids, and this is from the New York Times, and just about everybody else to be armed to the teeth, is that the good guys can shoot back whenever the bad guys show up to do harm. That is, in other words, they say that if every student would have been armed at Virginia Tech, this guy would have not been able to shoot. What did he kill? 38 something? 32?
That's really what we want, right, Peter? We really want every single person to have a gun.
Well, the problem is that there are so many accidents, so many. So the more guns there are, the more people with them, the easier they are to obtain it, the more problems you're going to have.
Yeah.
The more crazy people are going to get access to them, the more accidents they're going to have.
Right.
And interestingly, an important study published in 2009 by researchers at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine estimated that people in possession of a gun at the time of an assault were 4.5 times more likely to be shot during the assault than someone in a comparable situation without a gun.
So there goes that argument.
Yeah. So you can always have this anecdotal these incidents, where like the one that perhaps here this retired Detroit police officer, someone was attempting to rob him, and he responded by killing the person. So also then, armed robbery is what, probably a 20-year penalty? And this guy just upped it to execution. On average, the researchers said, guns did not seem to protect those who possessed them from being shot in an assault. Although successful defense of gun uses can and do occur, the findings of this study do not support the perception that such successes are likely. Now, I think what's going on here, guns are really, to many people, not if there's hunters, sports shooters, people that have, like collectors, bar owners, skeet shooters, I guess that's sports shooters and what have, and more than legitimate reasons for having guns. On the other hand, to a lot of people, it represents sort of a totem, a fetish. It's something, I have power.
I mean, everyone has a little fetish in them, but this one, whew.
In a society that sort of stripped the sense of personal empowerment from all of us, and it's just administered mainly by the elite, that sense that, yes, now I can protect myself, I can protect my family.
And I have some power, too.
And I have power, yeah.
I'm not powerless.
There's 100,000 shootings in the United States every year. Well, you know, though, maybe that's not a good argument for even having stricter gun control laws. Because, think about automobiles.
Oh, true.
If someone said we were going to introduce a consumer item that had a lot of utility to it, but was going to increase global warming, was going to do billions of dollars of property damage, and over and kill nearly 500,000 people every 10 years in this country alone.
Yeah.
But we'd like to introduce it. Can it get by like the Federal Trade Commission or the right. You know, people say, are you out of your mind?
I'm still not buying it.
Which?
The car argument.
You think we should ban cars?
No.
Think we should ban guns?
No, don't.
You can't do it.
Don't go there.
You can't do it. But
I don't want to ban guns.
All right.
No.
Well.
I don't like guns at all, but I'm not for banning guns.
So what I'm asking you, I'm not even necessarily asking you, what I'm asking anybody, what are we going to do about this? And won't the proliferation of more guns mean more people shooting one another?
This is going to sound real hopeless, but I really feel as though the situation is so incredibly out of control that there's no going back.
Why do we live in a country? What is so unique about this country that it's like Mexico or Pakistan or something like that.
We're right there with them, yeah.
Do we like that comparison? Does anybody have an idea of what is going on?
I'd rather be in one of the happiest countries in the world, like Norway or Finland.
Yeah. I mean, you have a situation where people were arguing, did the rhetoric of the right, these Republicans talking about they want an armed and dangerous population or crosshairs on a map, and all these writers saying, no, nothing we said had anything to do with it, although
You can follow it back.
You can follow it back. But they said it's just crazy people. Why do we have so many crazy people? Let's take their argument completely. Let's get the political thing out of it. Why do we live in a country where so many people, as they say about kindergartners, act out?
Well, they've closed down all the mental hospitals for starters, right?
Yeah, I suppose. But, you know, a lot of these people functioned normally.
Yeah.
Right, you know,
what made them go mad?
Yeah. I don't know. Okay, 313-298-WRIF.
I blame George Bush.
Right. It's got to be him.
If nothing else,
yeah,
blame Bush.
Why not? Let's see. What other great little items do we have here?
Keith Olbermann, are we going to talk about that?
Keith Olbermann, the leading liberal commentator on cable television.
MSNBC, yeah.
Yeah, gone.
Yeah, and apparently they've been planning this for a couple of weeks, and he just kind of said, I'm out of here, bye.
Yeah, it's kind of strange.
I think he was tired of fighting with management over there, and I think he's going to pop up elsewhere.
Now, there's a millionaire talk
show
host.
With a heart.
Yeah, that's actually fighting for ordinary people, not trying to get ordinary people to fight for corporations.
Absolutely.
that's right. That's the difference. That's what the righties are trying to do. The corporations need cannon fodder. And there's not enough of them because they're only 1%, 2%, something like that. So they've got to enlist some of you out there. And most of you are smart enough not to get on board. But also, you're not really at a point where you're fighting back at all of the successes that the elites have in dominating the political and economic life of this country. And we're kind of, you know, we have opinions, you know, we think Obama's bad or good, or we think this or that. But it never translates into any real fight back. In fact, but what I was trying to do, because I was going to go on with some negative stuff, that I have on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Why do you laugh?
Negative stuff warning.
Oh, no.
Okay.
It's all positive.
Oh.
Right up in front.
Right on.
I mean, it's got stuff like the big obscenity, $1 trillion a year to the richest 1%. I mean, we should know that. But it also has three incidences. I think some of them we talked about last week. It says, the more we fight back, the less they'll take. And essentially, that's what's happening. It's a system of looting that we live under. And you can call it democracy or capitalism or whatever you'd like to call it, is that the rich are getting richer, the middle class, the working class, and the poor are losing
wealth. Disappearing.
Yeah. Well, not the poor.
The middle class.
They're growing.
Right.
The poor is growing.
The middle class is disappearing.
So one of it is about how the United Electrical Workers, united with the community, stopped the sell-off of the machinery in this plant. It's a long story, but it actually is how people working together can stop the deindustrialization. Also, there's a new group called Roots Action, demanding an end to the Afghan war. Oh, remember that? America's longest war, which is undoubtedly going to be lost. And Barack Obama is going to do what? Well, he's not going to do anything about it till after the 2012 elections. And also, the baristas, those people that put together our coffee at Starbucks, have in New York City, the largest Starbucks in New York City, have joined the old Industrial Workers of the World Union, the IWW, which goes back to 1905.
Now, that's amazing.
And they're rad.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it when I read that.
You go to IWW.org. They used to organize the lumberjacks and the miners and people like that. Now
oh, my
baristas.
Gosh. Now it's baristas. Come a long way.
Well, it's a different economy,
yeah.
I suppose. Yeah. All right, let's see. I guess some people do want to talk about gun control. I mean,
of course.
One thing
it's
is
a topic.
It is not on the agenda, and there is going to be no gun control. So don't worry about that if you're a gun nut, right? And nobody's going to take away your 33-shot clips, and no one's going to take away your Glocks.
Nothing's going to change.
Yeah, nothing. No one's going to stop you from having assault rifles and all the whatever.
And just because we talk about it doesn't mean anything is going to change because of what we're saying. We'd like it to, but...
And almost every one of you who's listening that's a gun owner, nothing's going to change.
Yeah.
Including all the killings that happen every week. But I guess I would like some people to say, well, all right, I think that there should be, if you believe there should be restrictions. In fact, you know what? If you think there should be restrictions on guns or weaponry or clips or assault rifles, it's not even worth calling in because it's not going to happen. But I think those of you who think that there should be no controls on guns or accessories like clips, what do we do about the situation? Just kind of hope that we're not in the McDonald's when this guy comes in shooting?
Yeah, exactly, in the line of fire.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, who do you think would be the safest people in the country in the safest location? Wouldn't you think it would be police officers inside a police station? And instead, today, in Detroit, mm-hmm. a guy rushes in with a shotgun with a pistol grip and starts shooting cops. And it to the point where one of them, and maybe all of them, maybe with some police officers, you can tell me what the deal is. Do you all wear your vest inside
bulletproof
of
vest.
The...
Yeah, I'm curious about that, too.
Inside of the... You know, this is really like Mexico.
I guess, why not?
This is really like Mexico, except there, at least, it's not nuts that do it. It's criminal gangs that go after police and the federales.
It has a lot to do with drugs.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're organized. They're doing it with a purpose. These guys are just mad, you know, in the insane manner.
Yeah, and mad. Got an email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com from Jerry. Anyone who needs more than 10 shots to hit a target should not be carrying a gun. That's what Jerry says.
There you go. Again, I think it's a power thing. And there is a fascination.
See how big my gun is?
There is a fascination.
By the way, guys, it's such a turn on. Woo.
Yeah. I mean, you and women in leather bikinis with automatic weapons. Oh,
ooh,
God.
Nothing better.
You don't think that? I wonder. Should we Google that?
What?
Leather bikinis, automatic weapons.
I have better things to do.
All right, okay. Here's Mike down in sunny Florida, where I don't think it's 5 degrees. Mike, hi, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Welcome. Hey, man. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I wanted to kind of comment on the gun control thing. I've never owned a gun in my entire life. My dad's never owned a gun. His dad never owned a gun, and his dad's dad never owned a gun. If you go back 4 generations of my family, we never had guns in our family. We never had to have any guns because we're never in a situation where we needed one,
Wait a minute, Mike. The argument is you never know when you'll come across a situation like that. What if you're in a Walmart and all of a sudden a guy starts shooting?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, that's the argument that
and duck.
That if everyone had guns and then these shooters that get off multiple shots, see, if it would have been like a Tea Party rally down there in Tucson, it would have been some right-wing Congress, and everyone would have pulled out their gun and started shooting, right?
Yeah, just like the old Wild West.
Except they probably would have had more people shot because there would have been so much collateral damage. All right, thanks, Mike. Thank you for joining us. Here's Larry in St. Clair Shores. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello, yeah, I have an opinion about non-lethal weapons.
Sure.
I wish you weren't allowed to carry a real weapon out in public. You could only carry non-lethals, but you can't even buy them at Dunham's or any kind of store. You can buy a gun, but you can't even get non-lethals, mace, tasers, other ways to protect.
No, you can get mace.
Well, yeah, you can.
Yeah, you can get mace.
I think it is. Some of it's still illegal in certain.
The crime rate is actually going down. I'm sort of surprised because usually in periods of economic downturns or permanent recession, whatever you want to call it, crime goes up and assaultive crimes because people get increasingly desperate. But, I mean, usually when we talk about this, you know, I was born in Detroit, went to school in Detroit, a party in Detroit all the time. I go still into neighborhoods where I think probably a lot of people from the suburbs where I live now wouldn't occur to them to go there. I mean, I think at least pride myself. You can, call me foolish.
I've been in the car with you. I can attest to that.
I mean, there are people, for instance, my wife and Jaleen and I and friends have gone down to the Heidelberg Project, around Mount Elliott and Mack Avenue. Mm-hmm. And I go, man, it's the inner city. I wouldn't go down there. I mean, it wouldn't occur to me.
I didn't feel unsafe.
No, it wouldn't occur to me to have to have a gun there. There's certain, places I'm not going to be by myself at night. I know I'm not going to be there. But people have so exaggerated the at-risk factor for, for the necessity to carry a gun. Listen, if I thought I was at risk at all, if I thought my wife and I were at risk at all, I would have no problem about carrying a gun all the time. Mm-hmm. And if I thought I needed a 9mm Glock, I would be carrying that. I have absolutely no need, and I would say there's virtually no one that's listening that needs to carry a gun around here, unless you are like something like they used to have for concealed weapons. You're a bar owner, you're coming out with $1,500
right.
at 3 in the morning.
Party store owner.
Party store owners, stuff like that. Or, working in a liquor store in a poor neighborhood or something like that. But I think its utility value is way, way overrated in my estimation. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. The other thing I would like to see happen is maybe like a mental screening, that you would have to pay for an extra $50 or something. Cause I don't have any felonies or anything like that. I could purchase a gun, but I probably would fail the mental screening or something. You know what I mean?
Well, that's quite an admission, but that's good to,
that's
good to know. All right, Larry, thank you for joining us. Here's James in Westland. Hey, James, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter and Jaleen. It's been a while since I've called in. I find that this entire topic has been brought up about 1998 around Columbine shootings and the movie Bowling for Columbine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny that it's been brought up by another school shoot and by another a whole line of shootings that just very tragically and coincidentally in the same time period.
They're endless. But wait, you know what? I mean, certainly they're tragic in a way, but they're almost like auto accidents. And I read one time someone said, shouldn't call auto accidents accidents because they know they're going to happen. I mean, all the insurance companies,
actuaries or...
Yeah, they know. They're counting on X number of deaths, this much of property damage. They project into the fiscal year that they're involved in. Exactly how many people are going to be killed, injured, property damage, and how much this is all going to cost them. In the same manner, we can project that, there's going to be hundreds and maybe thousands of more shootings, that X number of people are going to die, X number of people are going to have commit suicide, X number of people are going to accidentally shoot themselves or someone in their family or one of their friends. So I'm...
Well, there's a very unfortunate violent fringe out there that have guns, and unfortunately there's not a lot we can do about it.
Well, I tend to agree. I don't think there is, on the political climate... There certainly the Republicans who, you know, milk that for partly their political power, and the Democrats who don't want to alienate anyone aren't going to do anything about it. So we're stuck with mass murders and individual murders and suicides by gun and people using them for holdups and everything like that. So what do we do?
Well,
I don't know. So you can say I don't know as well.
Tougher screening, tougher screening, tougher screening.
Well, they're not even going to put that in, I don't think. All right, thank you very much.
That's my suggestion.
Appreciate your call. Here's Cindy in Roseville. Hi, Cindy. You're on the air.
Hi, Jalene. Hi, Peter. How are you?
Hi.
Hi, Cindy.
I love you guys' show. I'm a little nervous. First-time caller.
Welcome.
Oh, don't be nervous.
Happy New Year to you guys.
You too.
I just wanted a quick comment on the shooting in Detroit, the police officers. There are too many miswired people, obviously. The thing that's really got me is they don't have the proper, I don't think, security there. They were saying before a guy on the news that they don't have, like, an enclosure where people would have a hard time, or bulletproof glass or something. And I think they need to do something about that.
You mean at police stations?
Yes, correct.
Well, you know, Cindy, you would, like I was saying earlier, you would think that would be the last place in the world that would need anything like that. I mean, this was what they sometimes could have very well met this definition of what they call suicide by cop. In other words, that this guy wanted to be taken out, because it's pretty hard to imagine that someone would go in by themselves. It's not like Mexico, where maybe 20 armed men with automatic weapons that they've gotten from the United States because of the NRA has made access to them so easy. So here was somebody that came in that must have realized at some level of insanity that he was going to be a dead man following this act. But, I mean, it goes back to my question, and again, I don't expect you to answer it because I can't answer it either. What in the world is happening in a country where something like this is so frequent?
Yes, unlike you, I have no clue.
Well,
terrible, isn't it?
It is, but I think we got to find out. Cindy, thank you for calling. Call us again. We'll be back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Hi, Mrs. Miller. I have the cookies ordered.
Oh, wonderful.
Okay, you have 5 boxes of Snacker Bubbles, 3 Little Yummers, and your total is $0.
You mean they're free?
Yep, they're free.
Well, it's a pleasure doing business with you.
Free is better. Do your simple federal return for free at TurboTax.com. It's free to prepare, free to print, and free to e-file. No wonder TurboTax is the most trusted brand of tax software in America. Visit TurboTax.com today. Trusted brand claim based on Intuit Commission Survey, August 2010.
This winter, you spend a lot of time indoors, so it's the perfect time to spruce up the inside of your home. Head to Lowe's, and right now you can get free basic carpet installation with purchase of Stainmaster carpet and Stainmaster carpet pad. And if your bathroom needs an update, you can save up to $400 on everything you'll need, like vanities, faucets, accessories, and more. And a Kobalt 8-piece screwdriver set was $19.98, now just $9.98. So come into Lowe's for more great savings. Experience. Lowe's. Let's build something together. Offer valid 1/19/11 to 1/24/11 while supplies last. See store for details. Valid in U.S. only.
How do you prepare for jobs involving electronics technology, drafting and design, or information technology? Call ITT Technical Institute. Develop knowledge and skills that you could use to pursue many opportunities in promising career fields. At ITT Tech, classes meet just a few days a week, and financial aid is available for those who qualify. Call ITT Tech now for more information. 800-741-5123. That's 800-741-5123.
These days, people of all ages, including adults, can have a perfect smile. Thanks to today's technology, people with crooked teeth may no longer need to wear metal braces. One option many adults prefer is invisible braces. Instead of the typical metal bands or brackets that are cemented to teeth, these braces are clear plastic trays. Some advantages of invisible braces are they can be removed for eating and for brushing and flossing. They are practically invisible to see, and they are less irritating to gums than traditional braces. Keep in mind that invisible braces are only available for people who need minor corrective work. If you are considering braces and would like to learn more about invisible braces, speak with your dentist. You're never too old for a beautiful smile. For the ADA Dental Minute, I'm Dr. Maria Lopez-Howell. For more information, visit our website at ada.org.
I guess we got caught up in the crazy housing boom.
We had been in the house so long, we didn't want to lose it.
What these people share is that they all got in trouble with their mortgages, and they all called a certified housing counselor for help.
Our housing counselor looked at our paperwork, and she knew something was wrong.
She understood what needed to be done, and she helped me work it out with the bank.
This is a free service. Call the National Foundation for Credit Counseling now. Call 1-866-687-6322 or visit mortgagehelpnow.org.
Does your furnace need repair? Your house need cleaning? Or maybe you're ready to update your kitchen. Big or small, whatever your home improvement need, now it's easy to find the right home pro for your project. Log on to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic is a free online resource with instant access to top-rated remodelers, maids, handymen, roofers, and many other home contractors. Just go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic has a network of licensed and insured contractors in hundreds of home improvement categories. If you need a painter, electrician, plumber, or any other home service, visit fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's easy and it's free, and it's the source to find neighbor-recommended contractors in your area. Now, you can hire a pre-screened home pro with confidence. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's quick, it's free, and there's no obligation. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. That's fixitfast.servicemagic.com.
It's Meltdown, and I want to hook you up with my personal Red Wings season tickets. Keep it locked right here on the Rip weekdays from 3 to 7 to score tickets to an upcoming Red Wings game and be registered to win that sweet party at the Joe, hosted by me at the end of the season, exclusively from your Detroit Red Wings at 101 WRIF.
Back with more Night Call. 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. Julie, you got an email, you said?
I do. Jason wrote in, and we've been talking about guns and gun control, and tonight's incident at a Detroit police precinct in which someone came in and just shot him up. He said, if guns kill people, then pencils cause misspelled words, which actually then should be then. That's misspelled. Anyway, and the guy that said you don't need more than 10 shots obviously has no training, Jason says. There's a reason police carry extra mags. Well,
that's for police.
We're talking about homeowners.
Yeah.
Citizens.
Yeah.
About the police shooting in Detroit, I ask, what makes the officers safer in the police station than on the streets? The vest should always be worn. I would think with all those cops around that it would be a little safer in there.
But I would think.
Clearly, there needs they're going to start putting up things like when you go into the courthouse, things like that.
Patrick from Mount Clemens writes, Dear Peter and Jolene, wondering what your thoughts were on Governor Snyder's State of the State address. I couldn't help but take notice when he yet again said that state and public workers' compensation needs to be looked at. And is part of the reason why we have such a budget deficit. As a public worker myself, I resent a multimillionaire saying my salary or pension is breaking the state. What a joke. As far as the police bulletproof vest question today, all officers wear a vest when in uniform, or they're supposed to anyway. So that answers that question.
Hey,
yeah.
Peter.
Yeah.
Abdel, who is in College Station, Texas, he's an international student from Chad, said he doesn't want to talk about gun control. He wrote in to Call Talk Yes. @yahoo.com. Like you said, it's not going to happen. Not this year, not next year. I want to talk about the whistleblower bill. I know it didn't pass because one unknown Republican senator decided to hold the bill. Talk about that. Can't Obama sign an executive order, and whatever happened to the fairness doctrine?
Wow, that's too much. The fairness doctrine, that's out the window. If a fairness doctrine, we probably wouldn't be on. But look, Josh, Derek, Tim, Dan, Mike, Paul, hang on. You want to comment on gun control? We brought this up. You have the right to talk about it. To some extent, it's a peripheral issue in the sense that, as Jalene and I have been saying, it's not going to be addressed. No one's going to do anything about it. The killings are going to continue. I was asking, what do people that think that we don't need any stricter gun laws, or that that nothing really should be prohibited other than automatic weapons,
right,
and stuff like that? What do we do, or what's the cause of all this? And if you think like it's not prayer in school anymore, you can make a suggestion like that. But but let's get to the nub of it, because we are into the nub of what's happening to our country right now in general, which is it's a economy, what all of us are concerned about. And guys, stay on the line. We'll get to you about this. But I want to bring this up because things have been good for, what do we call them? The rich devils, right? Remember a few shows ago? Goldman Sachs, remember them? They've been long among the most richly paid on Wall Street in the best of times. They are now poised to reap a windfall that was sown in the dark days of the Financial Times in 2008. We bailed them out. Now they're doing great. Nearly 36 million stock options were granted to employees in December 2008. 10 times the amount issued the previous year. And now they are going even beyond that. It all goes to the elite partnership of 475 people that run the firm.
Amazing.
Pay doubles for bosses at Viacom. Viacom awarded its chief executive, Felipe Dauman, total compensation for 2010 valued, you ready for this?
Ready.
$84.5 million.
Oh, must be nice.
More than double his 2009 figure, including salary, bonus, and stock options. And let's see, Thomas E. Dooley, he's the COO, the chief operating officer, he had a measly $64,700,000. Poor baby.
Poor baby.
Also, but all these guys aren't doing that well. Peter A. Hochfelder, the principal and founder of Brahman Capital Management, a private investment firm in Manhattan, is now stuck with two yachts.
He's stuck with the yachts.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I saw something. He can't unload these suckers.
He already owned a 134-foot Lursen named Blind Date that was built in 95. He commissioned a second boat in 2007, a 161-foot Trinity yacht that he christened with the same name.
Who needs two yachts?
And now he's only asking $9.5 million for the older yacht and $33 million for the new one.
Oh, my God.
Maintaining a yacht is expensive. They estimate that Mr. Hochfelder pays about $4 million a year to run his two boats. You getting this, folks? I mean, if you make over, I think, $180,000 a year, you're in the top 5%. So you make $180,000 a year. You're in the top 5% of wealth in this country. This guy's paying $4 million a year to run his yachts.
Oh, my gosh.
Let's see, J.P. Morgan posts strong profit as crisis fades.
Oh, the crisis is fading for J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, maybe in your neighborhood there's some foreclosed homes.
Yeah, you've driven around lately.
Yeah, your $24 an hour job has morphed into a $785.
Yeah. Or you've lost your home.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now the crisis is fading. Banks poised to pay dividends after a three-year gap. Many of them, of course, ones that we bailed out, Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo. So thank you, they should say. On the other hand, the reason I'm hesitating, I'm wondering whether I should go back to the...
I think you should get the phones.
Okay.
Because
I promise.
You already lost someone. A little patience.
Here's Mike. Mike is on the air, and I can't make out where you're calling from. Carlisle?
Clio.
What? Oh.
I'm from Clio.
Oh, Clio. C-L-I-O.
There you go.
Welcome. Yeah,
I know where Clio is. Yeah. Good. Go ahead.
I enjoy listening to your show. I work late at night and listen often. Friended you on Facebook as well.
Oh, great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anyway, gun laws, there's thousands of them. They don't work. When you make gun laws, you only affect the law-abiding citizens like you and myself. Criminals don't abide by them, so making more ain't going to help.
To
the bigger question you said, to how are we going to stem it, just education. We need to demand more from our government to educate our people.
Like how?
And,
I mean, educate them about what?
Just better education, you know. Detroit Public Schools is a mess.
Yeah.
And just common sense just isn't so common. And they need better mental health care as well, because this guy in Tucson, you know, he was kicked out of school and everything else, and they told his parents he needs help. All the warning signs were there.
They sure were.
So everyone, you know, society itself dropped the ball on this guy.
It did. Well,
everyone knew he was going to snap.
Maybe people will start paying a little more attention because of it, you would think.
So.
Or taking situations like this, more seriously.
Well, they call things learning situations, but it doesn't appear as anything has been learned. But wait a minute, Mike, they say that only, the crooks aren't going to pay any attention to gun laws. Part of it is what is allowed to be manufactured or imported. That George Bush let the automatic weapons or the semi-automatic assault weapons ban expire, whereas now they feel that through U.S. gun dealers that have given thousands and thousands of these assault rifles to these narcotraficantes in Mexico. So you could put a manufacturing ban on some of this stuff.
That just affects everyone's freedom. I was at a gun range today shooting a gun with a 10-shot clip in it. I know a guy who's, you mentioned earlier about thousands of rounds, you don't need them. A buddy of mine's got like 4,000 rounds that he reloads and goes and shoots. You can burn up 200, 300, 500 rounds a day if you want.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, but
and there's no sense in limiting what you manufacture, because people are going to harm people. And like you said, I don't know how you stop it, because you can't. The genie's out of the bottle.
Well, I tend to agree on that.
In Japan last year, there was a guy who, in a minivan, drove over a crowd of people and jumped out and started stabbing them.
Yep.
11 people.
Well,
own a gun in Japan.
You know, the largest school, how would you call it, the largest school killings ever occurred in Michigan in 1927 in some little town where this absolutely insane principal or somebody just laced the school with dynamite.
Then
blew it all up, and when the fire engines came, he drove up in a truck that also was filled with bombs, and he was driving it like one of these suicide bombers these days, and blew the whole thing up, wound up killing 45 people.
Wow.
Yeah. All right, Mike, thank you very much. Appreciate your call from Clio. And
one way to do it.
Yeah. So here's Derek and Howell. Derek, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, yeah, I just wanted to comment on the gun control thing also.
Sure.
I agree with Mike in the sense that no matter what you do, it's not going to stop. If you look back to Prohibition, they tried to ban alcohol, and people still found ways to get alcohol. Now, it may not be from the U.S. if you ban it from the U.S., but they're still gonna find it from other countries, or they're gonna find ways.
It would make it harder. And some of these gun dealers, like I said, that are supplying the Mexican outlaws with thousands of assault rifles that have there's a civil war there, and the federal authorities have essentially lost, and the narcotraficantes are controls all sorts of cities and what have you, and it's with weaponry produced in the United States and sold through U.S. gun dealers. It would seem to me that as gun owners, that we ought to have, at least the responsibility ought to be not allowing, more and more of these to proliferate in our society, but to control and to shrink their availability. That's not going to stop hunting or home defense or sport shooting or anything like that. But weapons of war, I don't think we need to have those manufactured in our country.
Yeah.
And are people going to import them from they don't have Eastern Bloc countries, but the former Eastern Bloc countries?
Right. Yeah,
maybe they will, but it sure becomes a lot harder. But no one's even going to propose that. I don't even know why I'm saying that. It's not on the agenda. It's, in fact, probably there's going to be less restrictions, and people are going to be able to carry guns just anywhere. And I don't know what that says about the kind of society. Well, I think it says a lot about the kind of society that we live in. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here is Jerry in St. Clair Shores. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Peter. I'd like to just discuss
I know all the details of the shooting in Detroit haven't come out yet, but I guess my point is that, you know, recently we had this decision reached in Chicago where a police officer was found guilty of torture, torture that took place over decades, was sending innocent people to prison, and he ends up with a sentence of 4.5 years. Even recently in Detroit, there was a SWAT raid that resulted in a 7-year-old little girl being gunned down by the police.
That was awful.
And we never heard any resolution to that. And then now, I guess my question is, it's to me personally, with a country with 5% of the world's population, yet we hold 20% of the world's prisoners, it's surprising that instances like this don't happen more often. And when you go up against the police state, you got to... Even if you have a complaint against a police officer, you have to go to a prosecutor who's an elected official who goes for the support of the police unions, the sheriff's unions, the Detroit Police Officers Association. They go for all these political endorsements. And then they go in front of a judge who's also an elected official who also seeks those endorsements. So to actually seek justice against a police officer, if you're confronted by that, it's not surprising. Well, any loss of life is terrible, but you know, when you see that, you can understand maybe some of these. We live in a police state. I'm sorry. And when you look at the police industrial complex.
Well, you know what? It sounds, Jerry, like you are wrapping about 6 things in together. I would suspect that there is no way that the man that went into the Detroit police station today and just began shooting at police officers had any sense. I mean, it wasn't like some, you know, old deal from the 1960s when there actually were at times police stations attacked by armed revolutionaries. But this was just somebody that decided this is the way he was going to commit suicide. We live in an extraordinarily violent society.
He felt wronged by them.
I bet it comes out a dozen.
Really?
But we'll see.
Yeah.
But in any event, we live in the most violent of all the G20 countries, the modern industrial countries. I mean, we are so far ahead of who's ever in second place. No matter how you cut it, whether, you know, whether people agree with you or they disagree with you, the raw figures are there about how 100,000 people are going to be shot this year, that these mass murders happen every single week to the point they don't even make the front page. I said last week, when someone is murdered in Windsor, which is, you know, about 8.5 miles from here, it's on the front page. One person is murdered. A husband murders a wife, or a wife...
on the front page for a week.
Yeah, it'll be the front page news. I'm not talking about, you know, mass murders or something like this. I mean, people in Canada look at us, or people in France or Italy or Norway or Sweden, places like that, Japan, they look at us the way we look at Mexico and Pakistan.
That's pretty sad.
It is. So my point is, something is wrong. And to get to the core of the violence is pretty difficult. It's rooted in our national psyche to the extent where we just have to hope that it doesn't visit us. It's sort of like the wheel of misfortune. When's it going to, you know, are we going to be in the wrong place at the wrong time? And the idea that people think that everyone should be armed all the time is such an indictment of a society that it's almost unbelievable. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
Peter, real quick, Daniel wrote in. He was on hold and dropped the call earlier. He said he had a friend who was an employee of the judiciary system. Hadn't seen him about 4 years. The guy came to town, came into his apartment, brought out his sidearm to show it off, and he balked. And he said he didn't say anything. He let him tote it around. Later that night, the guy does the same thing at a mutual friend's house. And the mutual friend's an ex-Marine, immediately said, without hesitation, get that out of my house now. And he said, well, what the point of my story? Both of these men had been given extensive training with their firearms. Only one, the latter, had ever used it, the one who wanted the gun out of the house.
Hmm. That's interesting. Hey, let me just as a sidebar here, while a number of you are, I was reading about, ready? You ready?
Yeah,
ready for me to start again? Okay. All right, here we go.
Bring it, Werby.
Yeah, we're talking about gun control, although nobody is really talking about gun control. In fact, we're not talking about gun control. We are talking about what does the proliferation of armaments, the fear of so many people that they actually feel we have to have them with us at all times, the fact that there are these mass murders, 100,000 shootings a year and all of that, that they're used extensively in holdups, that they're this export item to Mexico and what have you. But I wanted to go on just a little about, I was saying earlier, how the rich devils, I don't want to go back over why I'm calling them that, but crisis is fading, and J.P. Morgan and the banks and Viacom, all these other people, they're making a fortune. Well, here, this is an article called In Wreckage of Lost Jobs, Lost Power as well. This is by David Leonhardt in the New York Times. He says, alone among the world's economic powers, the United States is suffering through a deep jobs slump that can't be explained by the rest of the economy's performance. The gross domestic product here, the total value of all goods and services, has recovered from the recession better than in Britain, Germany, Japan, or Russia. Yet a greatly shrunken group of American workers working harder and more efficiently is producing these goods and services. Now, this is not a deep jobs slump. This is it, folks. This is the way it's going to be permanently unless we do something. Unless we, the people that are being affected by this, and you may have a job, you may have a nice home, but you know that somebody is going, you know, looking at your job category and think, can we combine this with three other guys and get rid of this person?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's happening everywhere.
But the whole thing about working harder and more efficiently, this means that the level of exploitation is, this is called old-fashioned speed up. Less people are working more. So this puts more money in the pockets of the owners. And less people are working, and more people then are competing for more jobs, which drives the price of labor down. Unions are no longer in any position to artificially raise the selling price of labor. So it's the conservatives' dream. It's a free market of labor, which means it's dropping precipitously. That means fast, quickly. A path is sought for states to escape their debt burdens. This says policymakers are working behind the scenes to come up with a way to let states declare bankruptcy and get out from under crushing debts, including the pensions they have promised to retired public workers. Those horrible people that taught your kids and defended your streets and put out the fires and swept the streets and were social workers.
Living in the streets.
And can you imagine that they dared to have pensions that are now bankrupting the state? Yeah, do you think it might have anything to do with the fact that we were reading earlier that there's people around that pay $4 million a year just for maintenance on their yachts?
Just for maintenance.
Forget about gun control. What about wealth control? And the good old Republicans, they want to just cut and cut and cut and cut. They want less and less expenditures. One of their big ones, they want to stop the almost $500 million a year, $445 million annual savings if you cut out all the money for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which means you wouldn't have PBS or NPR or anything like that, which they are dying to get rid of because they don't want even a centrist voice on the air. They characterize them as liberal. They want to get rid of the National Endowment for the Arts. They want to get rid of the National Endowment for the Humanities. They want to get rid of Amtrak subsidies. Every country in the world, every industrialized country in the world, heavily subsidizes its rail traffic so ordinary people can get hither and yon.
You know, these are the real sickos.
Yeah.
How do you get rid of art? How can you ever? I mean, I don't know. You know, I love that bumper sticker. Life without art is stupid.
You got to have art. That's another one. Listen, there's a little bit more to it. So if we need to relieve the debt and the deficit some, how do we do it? The Republicans want to cut spending. There's another way. And more on your calls on gun control when we come back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Could switching to Geico really save you 15% or more on car insurance?
Do only dogs hear dog whistles?
Enjoy multi-car safety feature and good driver discounts when you switch to GEICO. For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
Time's running out. You're maxed out on your credit cards. The collection calls are coming every day, and now you're two payments behind on your mortgage. Every time you turn on the radio, there's some cheerful couple telling you how they got out of debt overnight. Their stress is gone, and everything's just wonderful. Come on. The truth is, what sounds too good to be true is too good to be true. You need real help, and you need it now. Not bankruptcy. That should be your last choice. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're the attorney-driven program, dedicated to helping you get out of debt in months instead of years, saving you thousands, and without risking your family home. We know what we're doing, and we don't make promises we can't keep. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Get out of debt. Call Credit Card Relief at 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282.
It's Meltdown, and I want to hook you up with my personal Red Wings season tickets. Keep it locked right here on the Riff weekdays from 3 to 7 to score tickets to an upcoming Red Wings game and be registered to win that sweet party at the Joe, hosted by me at the end of the season, exclusively from your Detroit Red Wings at 101 WRIF.
The Riff. 101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome to our second hour. It's about 8 seconds shy of Monday. By noon on Monday, we'll have our podcast of this show up. And, hey, if you want to get a hold of us by email, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. You can go to my website for more information on what we're talking about. Wouldn't you think we would be giving more information here, Jolene? But actually, there's so many. Probably the written word contains more. Peter Werby, WERBE.com. We have a Facebook connection there as well. If you'd like to be our friend, we'd like to be yours as well. All right, so we were just going right before the break about all of the cuts. Well, two things. One, all the money that the rich firms are making and how some of the CEOs are getting like $85 million a year at the same time the wage structure of the middle class, particularly industrialized workers, has just absolutely been collapsing. The House Republicans want to cut $2.5 trillion in spending. No way in the world they would ever do it. Just like there's not going to be any gun control. There's not going to be any real cuts. This is what they just sold to the rubes, the people that said, we want the end of big government. No way in the world that they're going to cut all of that. But here, this is there's a wariness about cutting entitlements. As President Obama and Congress brace to battle over how to reduce chronic annual budget deficits, Americans overwhelmingly say that in general they prefer cutting government spending to paying higher taxes. Well, that makes, you know, when you say, would you rather have the government spend less, or right, would you want to raise your taxes?
They're kind of throwing out a big picture there. Yeah, I mean, right. Come on, they need to narrow this down and explain what it really means.
Right. You know, where, okay, let me tell you where some of this money is going here. Vice President Joseph Biden was in a couple of weeks ago or so, yeah, about 12 days ago, in Kabul, Afghanistan, where this war is going on, where Americans are getting killed, where Americans are killing people all the time and all that. It said, if the United States are prepared to stay, and we're not leaving in 2014, the vice president said, hopefully we'll have totally turned over to the Afghan security forces the ability to maintain the security of the country, but we are not leaving if you don't want us to leave.
Like, well, what security?
Yeah, that's... Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, Republican, says that having a few U.S. air bases in Afghanistan would be a benefit to the region. How much do you think that is going to
cost us?
Yeah. Graham said that he wants to see the U.S. have an enduring relationship with Afghanistan to ensure that it never falls back into the hands of terrorists. just like our pals in Saudi Arabia, where the terrorists actually came from on 9/11, and also that we give billions of dollars. Pakistani government salvages coalition, but at a steep price, it says. For the time being, Pakistan may remain dependent on international assistance, including billions of dollars in military and civilian aid from the United States, even as fewer than 2% of Pakistanis pay income tax, with many wealthy members of the government among those who pay nothing.
Wow.
The country's tax revenues will remain among the lowest in the world. Well, how about if they put that to you? Would you rather, how did they, what was the, I forgot now how they said that. But what would you rather, I've lost my...
What, have the taxes, higher taxes?
Oh, yeah, or cut services, essentially, entitlement services. Well, yeah.
Smaller government.
Yeah, would you rather have less military aid and civilian aid to Pakistan? Once you get into that, of course, there you go. U.S. will counter Chinese arms buildup. There's more billions right there. And it just goes on and on and on. I mean, they just have article after article about this as it goes on and on where our billions and billions of dollars go. So the point being, though, that this should not be what we are. Here it is. That it said that if there was a choice between cutting government spending or paying higher taxes, that people would choose cutting government spending. But then when it comes down to what they're getting, yet their preferences for spending cuts, even in programs that benefit them, dissolves when they are presented with specific options related to Medicare and Social Security, the programs that directly touch the most people and also are the biggest drivers of the government's projected long-term debt. So then people will say, yes, in order to maintain Medicare and Social Security, either for my parents or my grandparents or for us, I'm willing to pay higher taxes. Don't do that. Do not agree to pay any higher taxes. If you make under $180,000 a year, which puts you in the bottom 95% of the American population, you should not be paying any more taxes at all. And there is no reason in the world. All of this should come, as it says on this. Most Americans say tax the rich to balance the budget. Tax the rich. Take almost everything they've got.
Or just, cut those tax breaks, those Bush tax breaks, and we're way ahead of the game.
When I say take everything they've got, I mean, leave them with 6-8 million. Yeah. I mean, a guy is spending $4 million on the maintenance of his yacht. This could all
two
be solved.
Two yachts.
The other way you can
give
it.
Give the guy a break, Peter.
Yes, you could remove the cap on the Social Security, the FICA tax. Right now, if you make over $108,000 or something like that, you don't pay any more tax. So this guy from Viacom, who made $85 million last year, he's paying on $108,000 of it. So there's got to be just this very, very steep taxation that just, cuts the money off from those that don't need it and puts us in good financial shape, and then this won't even be a problem. All right. Here's somebody who's been waiting a long time. My apologies. It's Paul in Ann Arbor. Paul, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for waiting for so long.
Hey, you're welcome. I guess I'm going to say one thing about gun control, and then I'm going to link the two, if you'll bear with me.
Sure.
Okay.
Not gun control, but gun ownership, the myth thereof. Let's not forget, he who points first shoots. So how much of a deterrent, I mean, how much of a protection is it if you have this gun, if you don't have the intruder grant your request to be a gentleman and let you draw your gun so you have an even chance?
Yeah,
that's right.
Back to the Wild West again.
Exactly. Now, I propose that there's a linkage here, and it's kind of included in why we're allowing all this redistribution of wealth, if you will, to go all the way, 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 way up to the top, other than the fact we're being held captive by a hostile force, but that's another theory. But I propose that there is a pathology in the American psyche that Americans are basically self-loathing, pathological beings who suffer from something I'll call Wayne's World Syndrome.
Now, Wayne's World Syndrome, okay.
Wayne's World Syndrome is basically those rich people, they are so special.
We're not worthy.
We're not worthy, exactly. And that is what I think Americans, why they are so entrenched in this Tea Party nonsense, and they completely buy it hook, line, and sinker, and why the Republicans basically are going to win every election from here on to the end of time.
Well, you're much more pessimistic in general than I am, Paul. First off,
which is hard to do.
Yeah, that sector of the population is fairly small. I mean, if so many people stayed home for the 2010 elections, if everybody in this country voted all the time, I think the government would be overwhelmingly liberal all the time.
They're just given a very large microphone, as in Fox News.
Yeah, and
probably so.
And also, if you think, I mean, think about the Democrats and the Republicans. I forgot what the voter turnout was. It under 50%. It usually is in the midterm elections. And usually, there's very few percentage points that separate the two parties. So you're talking about maybe 25% of the population that votes for the Republicans. Okay? Well, I mean, that's the way the elections go. If that few people turn out,
And that's how few people turned out on the other side of the coin.
Well, either way. I mean, if only that many people turn out, you know, if only 10% of the population turned out and the Republicans won, that's the way the electoral system is set up. I mean, that's the way it goes. People in a lot of ways are, I don't think it's so much that people are marching lockstep to the right. It's just that there's complacency. There's this feeling that that voting doesn't do much good, that a lot of people only going to vote in the big elections, all of that.
Right.
Yeah. So, and the other thing is, you got to remember that the right is financed and organized by these billionaires. And they're all about political power and political power to continue to fleece the people of the United States, to eliminate all sorts of regulations on their ability to maximize profits. And they whip them all up with everything from insane conspiracy stories to racism to everything under the sun. So you've got people, rather than paying attention to the fact that we're being robbed by the people that are financing this right-wing movement called the Teabaggers, they instead are saying, Obama wasn't born in the United States. I mean, even if he wasn't, that's not the big issue.
That's not even the old man voice. What is that voice?
I don't know.
That's the crazy beggar voice. I like that one.
All right, Paul. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul.
Can I say something?
We had gotten an email earlier from Abdel, who's a student from Chad down in Texas, and he had a question for us, and this is one I do not know.
What's that?
So I don't know if you know it, Peter. If not, we'll throw it out there. Can a foreign, and I don't think Abdel wants a gun. He seems like a very reasonable guy. Can a foreigner under a student visa own a gun? So it says the Second Amendment clearly says the right of the people.
Yeah, well,
I don't know.
Maybe if you're a foreigner, because the people in the Second Amendment has a big capital P.
Yep. He put the capital P there.
I know, he did. So
he did. And he also had a few questions about how did the mortgage crisis start? Is it homeowners who couldn't pay because they took on an expensive mortgage, partially? Or is it the banks who, what did the banks do, actually? He said. And I'm curious. I'm always curious when people find our show, when you write back again, let us know how you found us.
Well, wait. But Abdel, you're spamming us. He also just wrote another email.
Is there
a show called Afghan Idol?
I don't know. American Idol in Afghanistan?
He said, what happens to Afghan Idol if the U.S. military leaves the country?
I don't know. You have a lot of questions, and I can tell. Sometimes when people find a show where they hear something that they actually feel inside of them and have never found a show like that, they get very excited. I know how I felt when I first started working on this show. So
now, the conservatives want to go back to the 1920s. The conservatives always want to conserve things as they are. I haven't run this out in a long time, but remember, they wanted to conserve the United States as a colony of the United States. They wanted to conserve slavery.
They'd like to get those women back barefoot and pregnant in that kitchen.
They're more modern than that.
Oh, now. Come on.
But at the time, they wanted to conserve white male voting rights only. The only thing they were ever positive for, they always supported every single war that came along.
True.
Most of them were just based totally on BS, you know, like the Spanish-American War and the First World War, Vietnam War, stuff like that. And they've never really recovered from the stinging any of those rebukes. I don't think they want slavery back. At least most of them don't want slavery back or segregation or anything like that.
Well, I should hope to shout.
Well, you scared me.
I hope not.
Yeah. Never mind. But they've never really recovered from the reforms of the 1930s that that brought us.
Even if they weren't here.
Yeah. Well, yeah. None of them are here. But that the Roosevelt and the New Deal, they never recovered from it. And they've been on this campaign to return things essentially to the 1920s. That means there's women's vote and there's no slavery. I guess there's segregation and all that. But one of the things that they that they've successfully done is that they've laced the whole judicial system with about 2/3 of Republican appointees, including the Supreme Court. And the two farthest right-wing ideologues on the court are Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas. And they were instrumental in this this landmark decision of about a year ago called Citizens United, which gave personhood to corporations. This is totally insane. And this meant that money is speech. So what's happened is these multi-millionaire right-wingers have funded everything from the Tea Party to these different
For example, the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H.
K-O-C-H.
They've thrown so much money at the baggers.
Now, Justices Scalia and Thomas are all tied in with the Koch brothers and their Koch industries. They don't want to be able to, they don't want to face any regulations on their, they're an energy company, and they've been spending millions and millions of dollars to fund both directly the Tea Party movement, the Tea Baggers, and also individual far right-wing candidates. So Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas, although they're directly connected with these two, I mean, it's such a criminal enterprise, it just defies the imagination. I mean, both these guys should be impeached. But here, I love this story here. Justices explain links to energy company.
Go ahead, Peter, tell us.
Two Supreme Court justices, Scalia and Thomas, have clarified their relationship with Koch Industries, the energy company that has been criticized by liberal groups for its spending on election campaigns. The two said Thursday they had spoken at dinners hosted by Charles Koch, a Kansas oil man who is one of Koch Industries' two principal owners, and his wife.
Oh, they just got paid a huge amount, hundreds of thousands of dollars to speak for them.
Well, they said that they paid the travel and housing expenses for both justices.
Yeah.
Justice Scalia spoke on international law at a January 2007 dinner, while Thomas discussed his memoir at the same location in Palm Springs, California. The advocacy group Common Cause filed a petition with the Justice Department on Wednesday asking it to decide whether the justices should have recused themselves, a new word that they were excused, themselves from the landmark Citizens United case, which directly benefited the Koch brothers and their plans to buy every single election herein that Paul just talked about and why he's so pessimistic about it. The petition said that if either justice appeared before Mr. Koch's group from 2008 to 2010 when the court was considering aspects of the case and they're hanging out with them, it should certainly raise serious issues of the appearance of impropriety and bias. Well, do you think?
Yeah, really. That's really a no-brainer there.
Yeah. Okay, let's go back.
Thoroughly disgusting.
Let's go back to our gun control show.
Let's go back to our phones. And, by the way, a couple of open lines. So we have about a half hour plus of show left. Give us a call.
And what number would that be?
313-298-9743 or 313-298-WRIF. You RIF people know this.
Here's Dominic in Taylor. Dominic, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. Hi. I just wanted to make a comment on the gun control thing. Like, with the way the situation is with the employment and everything, I think now would be the, like, not the best, but what what I'm saying is, like, it would be the, I guess I'd say, best time to own a handgun and carry it on you.
I mean, the risk factor is rising.
Yeah, because, like, even, like, with the kid, the dad that was a hardworking dad and just up and his children disappeared and they can't find him now.
Yeah.
It's normal people that are so desperate that they're going out any way to find means to support their family, they're going to do it.
Well, that's what I said. What do you think about this, Dominic? If not, probably 99.98% of gun owners are never going to do anything with them that's going to harm anybody else. But the more, it's like the more miles you drive, the more at risk you are for accidents by its very nature. The more people that have guns, the easier they are to procure, and the more firepower they have. Don't you think that raises the risk? I can get my tenses right. Raises the risk of problems?
The way I'm looking at it is, even a normal person, like, say they pass a mental whatever, that you had to pass a certain mental test.
Yeah.
If you're cornered and put into a situation, a sane person will do something irrational.
I agree. So what? Oh, that's an argument for or against gun ownership.
I owned guns. I don't own them anymore because I got in trouble. It had nothing to do with guns or robbing anybody or anything. But, if I could, I'd own a gun. But I don't think making more rules for guns is going to help.
Well, they're not going to make them.
Even the people that follow all the rules could be cornered and forced to do something stupid.
Yeah. Maybe I'll ask everybody this, too. Do you go anywhere in your daily life where you feel at risk? And some people feel so generally at risk that, that they want to carry a gun with them all the time.
I drive a street scooter, and we work in some of the really bad parts of Detroit. I've been, I guess you can say, kind of robbed. The guy was really nice. Like, he walked up to me, like, tried to be scary at first, and when he asked me if I wanted to die, and I was using a backpack blower, and I couldn't hear what he said, so I shut it off, and I asked him what he said, and he's like, "Can I have your wallet?" I told him no, and just started walking away. Well, he followed me all the way back to my truck where I was in the parking lot, and I was putting the blower in the back of the truck. And he came up behind me, tapped me on the shoulder, and said, "Can I have your wallet?" And I told him no again and got in the truck.
But well, like, you're gutsy.
Well, that's the one thing. Like, you guys always make it up to be, like, the bad parts of Detroit. From my opinion of Detroit, it's not bad. If you go there looking for trouble, you're going to get in trouble.
I go to Detroit all the time.
Never looking for trouble.
I wouldn't go somewhere where I thought I was at risk, or when I go places with my wife, I go to clubs. And I'm not just talking, I'm talking in, like I said, in areas where I think a lot of suburbanites that never go south of 8 Mile except to go to the stadiums or Hockey Town or something like that, or the Fillmore or the
DIA
Fox.
DIA or whatever.
They don't go to the DIA.
No. Okay. I do.
Yeah.
You do.
We do. All right, Dominic, thanks for the story. Yeah.
You would think, women are a lot more vulnerable. You would think there would be more women than men carrying these guns.
What do we have there? Well, let's say this. If one is concerned with risk, right, I would think that given how much at risk we are when we drive, that not only do we have these cars now that have airbags and all that,
right,
that we all really ought to dress like NASCAR drivers whenever we go on our cars. I was eating, where we eat all the time, Sunday mornings in Ferndale?
Uh-huh.
When we just left there, and there is this car that had I don't know what it was doing. It was up on the lawn of the post office.
Oh.
Smashed to hell, and here comes, the Ferndale EMS roaring up. And so, all right, so I'm thinking, what do I think I would do better with for my safety in Ferndale? Carry a gun or wear a crash helmet and fire-resistant clothing and stuff like that. Well, obviously the latter. And I guess if there are people out there that feel so at risk everywhere, I don't know what to say. I mean, I think people could say, how do you know how at risk I am? Well, I don't. I'm just saying, in the main, that we're not, there's crime around. There's people that get carjacked. There's people that get held up. And there's...
There always has been. I mean...
And I think violent crime is going down, isn't it?
Right. I don't know. Are we still the murder capital?
No, St. Louis.
Okay. Oh, yeah, St. Louis, because it kind of goes back Miami. I remember.
And all the rates are dropping.
Oh, right, right. I remember I lived here when it was the murder capital. Then I moved to Miami, and it was following me.
Something about, yeah. Oh, yeah, three. I forgot about that. Three young guys just got gunned down in Detroit. That looked like it was something to do with dog fighting.
Ring. It was awful.
So we don't even, three, you know.
That I'd like to talk about.
And that wasn't even front page. It wasn't even lead story.
And that is, I'll tell you, if it were in my hometown of the old Des Moines, Iowa, that would be big ass news.
313-298-WRIF. I should tell you real quickly. Let me get to my site here.
Oh, 1 o'clock.
Yeah, 1 o'clock. PeterWerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E. That's such a joke to you, every time I spell my name. not you listeners, but to Jolene. But people don't know how to spell it. All right. Oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you about this. Paul Clemens, who has written this book about Detroit called Punching Out, 1 Year in a Closing Auto Plant. It's the cover story of the Metro. I just thought it was a neat book. And I know this guy had written another book. What the hell was the name of it? A few years ago. But it's about how this Bud stamping plant was shut down. I mean,
physically.
And it's a fascinating story. It's on oh, man, what is it? We are being so deindustrialized. There's actually a publication called Plant Closing News.
That's sad.
Isn't that something?
It's really sad.
Well, you know, there's this enormous industry around deindustrialization.
I mean, one would imagine. Yeah, you would need that, right?
And also Gareth Porter, who's an investigative journalist, and he, this week was also the 50th anniversary of Dwight Eisenhower, the president Dwight Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex.
Hey, well, now we talk about that every week, every day. Hey, speaking of my hometown, I want to say hi to John, who's listening. He listens at WRIF.com, and he listens every week, and I'm just thrilled about that. So I'm glad we could get some of those Iowans in on this action here.
There you go. Here, Michael writes in the call talk, yes@yahoo.com. What will our planet look like in 10 years? I know it's a broad question, and there are many factors to consider. However, I can't get that post-apocalyptic sci-fi future image out of my head. We take our world for granted. I wonder if our descendants will hate us. Yeah, I think Michael,
they'll feel sorry for us.
Well, I think we feel sorry for them.
Yeah, well,
These are the good old days, dear.
Maybe there will be a revolution. They'll look back and say, look, these people were out of their minds.
Yeah. I got to get this one in real quickly. This is Jim in Detroit. He's a police officer, and he wants to comment on these horrible shootings. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going good. Not so good for you guys.
Yeah.
No. I'm really upset about a lot of things that happened. I'm very against, I mean, I'm a gun guy. I carry a gun every day.
Sure.
But the things that happened the last couple of days, Lovoni officer getting killed, then the Troy thing situation happened tonight, really upsetting me.
And you're an actual police officer, and you see this every day. So for you to feel that way, to me, says a lot. Would you agree, Peter?
Sure. And what, they ever find out what motivated this guy to invade a police
precinct?
Precinct?
I agree. There's a lot of problems right now with gun control. I agree 100%. U.S., We've grown accustomed to having guns, but this whole thing just hurt me. The whole thing hurts me right now.
I can imagine.
What did you know these people?
I did know them.
Oh, man.
You know,
whether you did or not, it's sad, but I'm just saying I can understand why you're feeling it a little deeper.
And I mean, the only good news in it all that no one lost their life other than the shooter.
Right, I agree. But the problem is, with gun control, I mean, we can say, hey, we're going to take these guys' guns. I carry a gun every day. You could carry a gun every day. But you know what? These crazies, I chase more people left and right with guns that shouldn't have them. I mean, what's the real answer for that?
I don't know. I don't know, Jim. I mean, nobody.
You're the one who sees all these illegal guns. You're out on the streets, right? I mean, this is.
I do.
Daily occurrence for you.
You know what?
And Peter, I agree with a lot of things you say. I agree with a lot of it. I'm leftist millist, but.
Yeah, well, we're glad you're over on our side a little bit. That's cool.
You know. I don't know how much you follow what goes on in Mexico, but you know, I mean, there. I said earlier, I don't know if you heard the whole show, but rather than one crazy guy running into a police precinct, a precinct down there will be attacked by 20 or 30 guys with automatic weapons.
Yeah, down in Mexico.
I have seen that.
And I don't know. Are we heading that way? I hope not.
That's what I worry about. That's what I worry about every day, because Detroit does not have secure facilities, and that's a problem. If you go to the suburbs, they don't have this.
Well, and you know what? Here's the thing. Detroit has no money, so how can they even afford to update those when they can't do anything about the school system and on? That's kind of
right,
grim.
Right, and I agree with that 100%. 100%.
Yeah. Well, Jim, all of us, of course, and you know, I forgot, I shouldn't have, I forgot all about the Livonia police officer who was just shot.
Right.
Said thousands of people came out for his funeral.
So in the last 5 days, we've had 5 officers shot.
Now.
And right here. I mean, how's this country going? Are people that upset that they're going to...
I don't know.
They're going to go out there and kill officers?
It's just sort of.
We don't know, you know, what the deal is. And what we usually try to do when things like this, like what happened in Arizona, is we try to reserve as much judgment as possible and we'll see how it plays out. Well, it could be mentally ill. He could be mad at one of those officers. I don't know.
I bet he's mentally ill. Jim, I got to go. So thank you so much.
Peter,
and,
thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Thanks
for
coming.
I appreciate you.
Long-time listener.
All right. Well, thank you.
Be safe out there.
Yeah. Stay safe and indeed. Wow.
And thanks for keeping us safe.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Nightfall with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
We know you love to save money. That's why we know you'll love MotorCityDailyDeal.com. Each weekday, MotorCityDailyDeal.com sends an unbelievable deal right to your inbox. We're working with local businesses to make sure these deals save you 50 to 85% off. Restaurants, salons, spas, events, and more. You get incredible deals from great local businesses like these.
Rude Trends in Westland, Honey Tree Grill in Coney in Oxford and Belleville, and Merifit Fat Binding Complexer in Detroit.
And these deals are so good, they're only available for 24 hours. That's right, just 24 hours, then they're gone. MotorCityDailyDeal.com. It's your new local way to save on all the cool things you love to eat, see, and do. Log on, sign up, and save with MotorCityDailyDeal.com. That's MotorCityDailyDeal.com. MotorCityDailyDeal.com.
Why do we go through so much hassle for our morning coffee? We make it. Wait in line for it. Fuss with cream and sugar. There has to be a faster and easier way to shake the morning buzz. There is. 5-Hour Energy. It's ready right now. No making, waiting, or fussing required. And it really works. Just open it up, knock it back, you're done in seconds. Now that's fast and easy. 5-Hour Energy. The no wait, no hassle way to a great morning. Try it today.
Individual results may vary. See 5hourenergy.com for more details.
It's amazing how great your home looks with new Carpenter flooring, especially when you get an amazing value from a company you trust. That's why you should call Sears Flooring. With Sears Flooring, you'll save 20% right now. Just call 1-888-491-3939, and Sears Flooring will bring the showroom to you. Sears has a wide range of carpet, tile, hardwood, or laminate to match your style and budget. Your new flooring will be precisely installed, and your satisfaction is guaranteed. So call Sears Flooring for a free in-home consultation. You'll save 20%. Call 1-888-491-3939. Hurry. Offer ends soon. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. Call Sears Flooring now and save 20%. Call 1-888-491-3939. 1-888-491-3939. Sears.
Is this on? Thank you. All right. Good morning, students. This is your principal speaking. Please listen closely to the following schedule changes. First period will be replaced by sleeping in. Second period will be replaced by warm weather. Third period will be replaced by belly flops. Fourth period will be replaced by goofing around. Fifth period will be replaced by batting leadoff. But there will be no changes to lunch. It will be in session every day.
School may be out for summer, but lunch is always in session. If your kids rely on subsidized school meals, call Gleaners Community Food Bank of Southeastern Michigan at 1-866-GLEANER or visit feedingamerica.org/summermeals.
A public service announcement brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Yes. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
You cannot petition the Lord with prayer!
Hi, Jim Morrison. Thank you very much. Well, thankfully, the Republican governor of Alabama, Robert Bentley, has apologized. Well, no. But did he, wait a minute, did he apologize? Because what he said was that if you were not a born-again Christian, you were not one of his brothers and sisters.
All right, later, dude.
Yeah, and then there were a few people got upset. Non-believer, Jews, Muslims.
Yeah, just a couple other, you know, outside of that born-again.
Well, 70% of the people in Alabama consider themselves born-again Christians.
No kidding.
But, he did apologize. And then he had some monkey-ass story about that he was trying to say or that.
He was BSing. He was trying to backtrack his way out of it, right?
And again, since, like the baggers, I always have my little copy of the Constitution with me.
You're such a good boy.
I am indeed. In Article 6, one of the things that it says, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. This, of course, written in the late 18th century, where it was taken as for granted that church and state would be intertwined here. The Founding Fathers said that no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States.
Well, this guy obviously hasn't read his Constitution lately.
Yeah. What else in here? They're getting these far right-wing evangelical Christians to host the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C. I thought these things were unconstitutional.
Oh, it's a big, big week for them. And that's coming up on the 1st of February, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, tomorrow, isn't there a Roe v. Wade? There's a big march. The anti-abortion folks are marching in Washington.
Oh, they always have. Well, yeah. Now, the first order of business for the Republicans here.
Take away a woman's rights to choose.
That was number two. The first thing was take away people's health care.
Okay.
Now they've got this extraordinarily extreme version of an anti-abortion federal law. And one of the things that's happening is that so many of the state legislatures, including Michigan, which is controlled by far-right-wing Republicans, both houses and the governor, Snyder, are anti-abortion. So these people that want to get the government off your back, they're going to have these male legislators vote away a woman's...
Okay, once again, do I have to say this again? Do I have to? Okay, I do. U.S., get out of my uterus.
There you go.
Thank you.
Eric in Sarnia writes in the call, talkyes at yahoo.com. The second most dangerous city in America laid off about two-thirds of their police force. That would be Camden, New Jersey. So they joined the list of cities like Flint, which laid off about one-third of their police. You know, that certainly was troublesome. And I know the suburb that we live in, Jillian, they've done everything possible. In fact, there's a millage vote coming up where if we want to keep all the police, unlike Ferndale, for instance, that laid off a police and fire, we're going to have to vote to tax ourselves a little more, which I'm going to vote for. Usually I say, you know, no more taxes, let the rich pay them. But I think in this specific case, at least I don't think much of a choice. But the fact that in order to keep the populace under control, that we need this huge police apparatus, again, says something about the country. If there were no police, would you go break into your neighbor's house?
Hell no.
You had to think about it for a second.
No, I didn't.
You did. You hesitated.
Peter, stop it.
Well, most of it.
Take that back.
Yeah. But when things...
I love my neighbors.
When the social contract begins to fray, like it has mega big time in this country, that's where you have to start thinking about, you know, the population starts thinking about arming itself. You know, we can't do without a heavy, you know, police presence and all of that. All right, here, oh, Mike from Royal Oak, man, you get the record tonight for being so patient. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're doing good.
Doing great. I think you should give him an extra minute or two for that, Peter.
Go ahead.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it. Yeah, I'm talking about the gun control thing you guys seem to be against.
Oh, wait, we'll see if we give you an extra minute or not. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I figured that would be...
what did we say? Let me ask you this. What did we?
I kid.
What made you think what you thought about what we said? What did we
say? I was listening to you for 38 minutes.
Oh.
Pretty apparent.
I was going to say years.
He's angry.
No, I'm just, like, wondering really exactly where your agenda lies on my safety. You know, now, if the police can guarantee my safety 100%, no problem. I'll wing right over to the Royal Police Station, throw all my guns up on the counter and say, here you go. Have at it. You know, no problem. You know, as long as you can guarantee my safety 100%, they can't. Before they actually...
I don't think a cop... just because...
That's not what he's saying. He's saying...
I know. I know, but there's no way that they could ever guarantee
you. Well, that's what he's saying. So, how do you feel living in a nice suburb like Royal Oak that you're at risk?
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? I had a pistol permit since 2003. I ain't even close to being at risk. People call me paranoid. You know what? I ain't paranoid at all.
Okay.
I mean, I feel, you know what? I feel very safe. The guy from Ann Arbor says, oh, yeah, you think the guy's going to, you know, the criminal's going to give you the chance to pull your gun? You need to wait for the break. You wait for the break. You don't want to pull unless you really.
Why do these thoughts even go around your head, Mike? You're not at risk. You're okay. You don't need a gun.
Sure. Well, wouldn't they say that?
Have you ever had someone? Ever had an incident? You say you own the gun.
Some people do.
Have you ever?
Oh yeah. Yeah. My neighbor's house got robbed. There was one guy that just got out of prison. I looked up as soon as his name appeared in the paper. He actually robbed 11 houses right up and down my street.
Oh, there's people. Listen, there was a kid next door that was breaking into every... He liked us. He broke in... This was quite a few years ago.
Was he the one who we saw?
You never saw him, no.
Okay.
And he broke into almost every house on the block other than ours.
Really?
But they were, you know, sneak thief stuff that when people went to work...
That fierce dog.
You got that pit bull.
Yeah. You
know? But I don't know, Mike. You know, I don't think there's any dissuading people. If people feel at risk or they feel the only way that they can be safe. And I mean, are you talking about carrying one or one in your house?
Oh, no, I carry one.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, you're like a lot of people. A lot of people.
So all right. Thank you, Mike.
On, man. Glad you feel safe. Anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Me, there's absolutely no need. And it's like I said, you know, there's all sorts of things could happen. Once in a while, meteorites hit the planet and, you know, I mean, listen, I lived in Highland Park for years. And one of the reasons we moved to the suburbs is that we got broken into it repeatedly. And mm-hmm. which I had the option of moving out of there. I mean, a lot of the residents didn't because they were poor. But
that's true.
It wasn't a situation. In fact, I was worried that you know, we had guns in the house. We had to like hide the gun, you know, really, because I was afraid the guns were going to get stolen.
Right. Yeah.
Or that I was going to come home and there would be somebody say, "Hey, welcome home." You know,
yeah,
and all
right.
of a sudden I'm staring,
yeah.
staring down the battle of my Mossberg. You know. But in any event. It never stopped. You know, people broke in when we weren't there. I never felt like I had to, even living in a high crime area like that, I never felt like I had to
pull a gun on.
I never had to carry a gun.
Oh, with you everywhere you went.
And I would if I thought I was at risk. And so, mm-hmm. what does it mean? Either Mike, he says he's not paranoid. So is he over assessing risk, or am I delusionary?
I don't know. To each his own, I guess. You know, yeah. That's the way it goes. You know, and I'm not going to get off of the gun subject. Just a quick thing. Jack LaLanne, the exercise
oh,
guru,
yeah.
96 years old, passed away today or yesterday. And I was just watching his juicer infomercial the other day.
No more push-ups for Jack.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Here's Caleb in Port Huron. Hey, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Turn your radio off.
Oh. What I think about the gun control thing is, it's kind of mixed with me. Because when you think about it, like, we kind of need it, but then again, we really don't. You understand?
Well,
that's
maybe you do and maybe you don't.
That's a broad statement, but oh, yeah, you sure? Okay.
Yeah.
Because, like, the reason we need it is, like, yes, you, like, we shouldn't be, America shouldn't be producing weapons for other countries in, like Mexico, where they're having a civil war, and they could turn all bad for the U.S.
Sure.
But we should be producing weapons for America because, you know, I mean, I don't know you, but I wouldn't want, like, you know, my fellow neighbor, like, my American soldier out there with some, like, a Chinese-made gun. I mean, that wouldn't feel right. I mean...
Well, if you're talking about weapons of war, I mean, the United States, in fact, that's our largest domestic industrial export.
Oh, yeah.
Our weapons.
We arm many countries.
We arm the whole world.
Yeah, we do.
Here's Bob and Warren. Bob, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good.
All right. First thing I want to tell you is I was at the fireworks this year. Are your reports on all your crime?
Yeah.
They're false. Because we were at the fireworks, we were at the Greektown Casino. We started to walk down the street to go to the fireworks, and everybody turned around and started going the other direction. Well, I went up to go see what was happening, and there was two gangs shooting against each other, and they were 15-year-old kids in the gang.
They can get crazy.
Okay, so what happened was they're shooting at each other. They had the Border Patrol, State Police, Detroit Police, all over there. There had to be 36 different cop cars out there. And not one of those things were put on the news whatsoever. I mean, Channel 4 is up on the roof doing their show, and nobody reported anything.
Huh.
So how could that possibly happen?
That, you know? Too busy of a news night, I guess, huh?
I mean, for real. I mean, come on.
Well, it could be. You know, they always want to put the best face possible. And there's often problems.
Especially when they spend millions on that display.
Yeah, there's often been problems with unruly young people
gang
down there. Yeah, and I haven't been down there in years.
Me neither. You won't. No way.
Well, there's too many people.
Can't take
but,
it.
I'm not giving it away. I have actually a place I can go and you can see it and probably
right,
not have
yeah.
those kind of problems.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe it is just a little bit of news suppression. I don't know what to say, Bob. All right. Thank you. Here,
if it were a slow news day, you bet
is, Mike and Warren. Hey, Mike, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi. I have been mugged 5 times
wow.
in my life.
Wow.
Twice in Texas, twice in Detroit, and once in Europe. I'm a firm believer in caring.
Well, maybe if someone has that kind of experience.
Yeah, if it sounds like a lot of bad luck.
Yeah, that does not sound like. How did you? Most people don't get mugged once in a lifetime. How did you wind up with 5? Without all the details.
I was in the military when I got mugged in Texas, and it was military people that were doing the mugging.
Wow.
And I did not have a piece on me at the time. But what I did have was a lock and a belt that were hooked together that was like a mace. And that stopped the mugging. I've never got actually mugged. They never got anything from me. I've never been allowed myself to be a victim. I'm a biter. I am a block of steel.
Well, it doesn't sound like...
if I need a bodyguard, I'm calling
yeah,
you.
Yeah, and it doesn't sound like you need a gun. You're doing all right with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you're a natural block of steel.
I got to go, Mike, because we got a lot more callers to go before the end of this. We're towards the end of our segment here. Here's Greg in Dearborn. Hi, Greg, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter and Julian. Good Hi. Show tonight.
Hi, Greg.
Thank
thanks.
You.
Yeah, I was listening to 60 Minutes earlier. I'm at work. I'm a proud member of UAW here. And,
right
I'm
on.
Working right now. Oh, yeah, it's cold out. But anyways.
You're working outside?
No, I'm working inside. I'm on my break right now.
Okay.
In my van.
But, all right.
Anyways, I was listening, and they said that there was a statistic about, they said like 73-75% of conviction reversals due to DNA evidence, and the convictions were originally based on eyewitness testimony. And they were saying that this could be a threat in all eyewitness testimonies in all cases around the country because it shows this trend.
Well, there has been a lot of challenging of eyewitnesses. I mean, I was thinking this Detroit rapist, the serial rapist, they say they just caught him.
Yeah.
Seven women ID'd him, and he says he's not guilty.
My gosh.
So, I don't know.
They matched his, matched his DNA.
Oh, they got his DNA. Yeah. All right. They got, you know, Illinois is, they've passed a law outlawing capital punishment because of two things. One, there were so many people that, that first off, just they found out
they were not guilty.
They're not guilty. And then you had that, that whole, Homicide Bureau of the Chicago Police that were torturing confessions out of black men.
Right.
That's what somebody earlier in the show, this guy wound up, a guy probably wound up getting people executed. I'm sure he did. He wound up getting 4.5 years in jail.
My gosh.
Wow.
Tim in Danbury, Connecticut wrote in to Call Talk Yes, and he said he just wanted to say he lives in Connecticut and listens every Sunday night and enjoys the show. Keep up the great work. We appreciate that.
Hey.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you. Where's our international crew?
Well, we did receive something from
Canada.
No, there was something from Sweden last week or Switzerland. Remember?
Yes.
They're out there.
All right. Here is Ron in Shelby Township. Hey, Ron, you're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're good.
Great. Hi.
As far as the whole gun issue, you don't need them. Nobody needs them. You know what I'm saying? What do you need them for? The only thing that they're made to do is kill.
Sure.
Some would say defend, but
what would you say, maybe other than what I said? That one caller said that I from Royal Oak, he said, I can't guarantee his safety, and he feels the necessity to go around the area of Royal Oak. He did say someone had been broken into. I mean, I don't think there's a neighborhood in America that hasn't broken into.
That's right. Even in a lot of very wealthy neighborhoods, because people realize
that's where the goods are.
Yeah.
But it doesn't occur to me, if there's a break-in in my neighborhood, it doesn't occur to me to go out and carry a gun, because what these people are doing are waiting till
right. What are they going to get you while you're walking your dog?
Yeah.
Okay, here's the whole deal on the gun thing. If you shoot someone to wound someone, you get in trouble for it.
Yeah.
If you shoot them to detain them, to wound them, you're gonna get yourself in trouble. If you pull a gun to defend yourself, you're trained to shoot to kill.
Sure.
Period.
Sure.
Alright?
Yeah.
So what's the point? Are you gonna go out there and kill him because he broke into a house?
Well, you know, there is a feeling. In fact, I'm not sure what law is on that. You cannot just shoot somebody because they've broken into your house. If you feel threatened, that's
self-defense.
Yeah, self-defense. But as you can say, you know, and I've heard people say, and I can't imagine anything more
terrifying,
transgressive. Than someone breaking into your house, and you know whether you're there or not. When you're there, I mean, it was just the most amazing thing. There's a lawyer I know that actually caught somebody breaking into his house, and he's this real gentle guy, and he tells this story. He said, "Then I pulled that gun." You know, I mean, it was
crazy man.
You know, and the idea is sometimes when people have shot people that have come into the house, they say, "He shouldn't have been in my house." And you know what? He shouldn't have been.
He shouldn't have been.
Shouldn't have been.
Right.
All right. Thank you.
Ron Paul Rick in East Point, as we call him. So glad you brought up Mexico, Pete. Guns are banned in Mexico. Since guns have been banned, there are over 30,000 people have been killed by guns. The people are unable to defend themselves from criminals. When guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns.
That's so idiotic.
Ron Paul Rick.
Come on. Get.
Sorry, I read it, Peter.
Yeah. For one thing, you know, you're not following the discussion. We're not talking about gun control. We said that there's not going to be any gun control.
Nothing's gonna
and
happen.
Americans are going to keep killing one another. They're going to kill police officers. They're going to kill their families. Nutballs are going to be motivated by all these right-wing talk show guys and go shoot politicians and what have you. So nothing will change.
Right. And really quick, I have to – I'm sorry.
Oh, you
have
to go?
I've got a date. Doug wrote in and said he thinks it's unfair to blame all the gun shootings on the mentally ill, which we really are not.
Right.
We're not doing that, Doug. He said he's on meds, he's highly functional, married for over 15 years, and he's a grad student. The thought that I couldn't get a gun if I needed to, he thinks that's unfair. I really think to blame gun violence on the mentally ill is disingenuous. We are not.
How do you sort people out?
We
I mean, that's what I mean.
We are not blaming it only on the mentally ill. Please don't think that.
All right, we just got time for a couple more calls. Hey, it's Mike in Ann Arbor. This is the night for Mike's. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter and Julian, how you guys doing?
Hi.
Great, thanks.
Hey, I started listening recently, and I love your show. I just started listening driving on the way home from work one night, and I've been hooked ever since.
Well, thank you. Welcome.
I've been listening tonight, again, on my drive home. We're talking about the shootings here recently, and I just wanted to make a couple comments. The first one is a possible retaliation cause. I don't think anyone has revealed the motive behind it right now, but I do have some friends who are in law enforcement. And we've had lots of discussions about various things. And lately, they've even noticed a trend in, well, their upper echelon in management is pushing these guys to hand out tickets. You know, they say there's no quotas,
yeah.
but they're pushing them to hand out tickets because it generates revenues for the cities. I believe there was even a news report done on one of the major networks about that, cities in Michigan who were pushing that.
I'm pushing it for my street. But go ahead.
Well, my impression is that police are harassing the public, law-abiding citizens more, and people are getting to the I'm mad I can't take it anymore point.
Well, I don't know, from getting traffic tickets. I mean, the officer in Livonia was just these two career criminal brothers, and I'm sure that this man in Detroit's going to turn out to just be a whack job that essentially committed suicide by cop. I mean, what else could he think other than to go in there? And think about how many people. In fact, I would bet, like the guy that just shot up Walmart's yesterday,
Seattle.
And shot two deputies and what have you. Yeah, it's crazy. All right, thank you very much. Let me see if I can do this real quickly. You have about 30 seconds. Give me a quick one. Yep, wait a minute. Sorry, go ahead. 30 seconds. Go ahead.
You need to see
Joe, sorry. Joe from Trenton. Sorry. Joe.
Oh, hey, Peter. Hi, Julie. How you guys doing?
Hey, Joe, good.
Joe, you got 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, we got 30 seconds. I recall in the past they had a cash for guns program. Now, I'm not sure the efficacy of that or all of the details or the strength, but I'm a little bit concerned about how that panned out.
Well, you know what? I don't think it's had any discernible.
Didn't make a real big difference.
It didn't make a dent. I've never really seen any evaluation of it. But thank you, Joe. Let me get my last caller in here. Patrick from Detroit, give me a sentence or two, and then we got to go.
Hey, this is Patrick from Detroit.
Hi.
The caller called. You're not shooting to kill someone. That's premeditated.
Right.
You're shooting to defend yourself.
All right. We got to leave it at that because we're out of time. Thank you, Patrick, for making that distinction.
Thank you, Aaron, for
thank
doing
you,
a great
Aaron.
Job on the phone
thank
tonight.
You.
We appreciate it.
Thank you, Jade.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you,
everybody. We'll be back next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Does your furnace need repair? Your house need cleaning? Or maybe you're ready to update your kitchen. Big or small, whatever your home improvement need, now it's easy to find the right home pro for your project. Log on to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic is a free online resource with instant access to top-rated remodelers, maids, handymen, roofers, and many other home contractors. Just go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic has a network of licensed and insured contractors in hundreds of home improvement categories. If you need a painter, electrician, plumber, or any other home service, visit fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's easy and it's free, and it's the source to find neighbor-recommended contractors in your area. Now, you can hire a pre-screened home pro with confidence. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's quick, it's free, and there's no obligation. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. That's fixitfast.servicemagic.com.
How much will your next car repair cost? If you have premium auto protection, there's no worry. You'll never have to pay a car repair bill again. Car repairs are expensive. $3,000 for a new transmission or $4,000 for a new engine can really set you back. But not if you have premium auto protection. They'll cover the cost of your car repairs. You choose the repair shop and premium auto protection pays them directly. You'll never pay a car repair bill again. Premium covers your car, truck, or SUV repairs. And they offer free road service and rental cars. You get top quality service. Satisfaction guaranteed. If your car is less than 10 years old with less than 150,000 miles, call Premium Auto Protection for your free quote. You'll never pay a car repair bill again. Call 866-960-2525. That's 866-960-2525. 866-960-2525.
Does your furnace need repair? Does your house need cleaning? Or maybe you're ready to update your kitchen. Big or small, whatever your home improvement need, log on to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic is a free online resource with instant access to top-rated remodelers, maids, handymen, roofers, and many other home contractors. It's easy and it's free. Just go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. fixitfast.servicemagic.com. fixitfast.servicemagic.com.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, here's a story about our city. And often we don't think of it in terms of good news. And one of the things that's laid us low over the last, and some people would almost say 50 years, has been the deindustrialization of Detroit. From the arsenal of democracy during World War II and massive auto production and hundreds of thousands of union workers making these autos that are sent all across the world. Now, I don't know, what's the big industry here? Fast food, pizzas, something like that. It, you know, there's a story there besides just the economic and technological end of it. There's real people involved and not just the individual stories of the economic impact or the social impact, but a pretty expansive one. Joining me is Paul Clemens, and he's a Detroiter. He was born in Detroit in 1973. Paul is here, and I was looking for the book. He was nice enough. Thank you, Paul. Paul said, do you edit? I said, no. Here's proof of it. The book is called Punching Out, 1 Year in a Closing Auto Plant. Paul was born in Detroit in 1973, and he was raised on the city's east side. His work has appeared in the New York Times, New York Times Magazine. And his book, Made in Detroit, was a 2005 New York Times Book Review notable book. He's the recipient of a 2008 Guggenheim Fellowship. Best of all, he's here in the studio with me now. Paul Clemens, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we're talking about the Bud Company. It had the auto stamping plant over on the east side. That was part of this galaxy of what made Detroit the Motor City. Tell us the basis of the book and why you chose the Bud Company plant.
Well, back in the spring of 2006, I was trying to come up with an idea for a book, and I knew I wanted to write about the decline of the working class or the troubles of the working class. But I didn't know how to get into that topic. It's a big issue. It's a big topic, and, you know, how do you get your arms around it? Then in May of 2006, I saw the closing announcement in the Free Press and in the news and in the New York Times. It said historic plant on the east side to close. I was born and raised on the east side. I had heard of the Bud plant, and I thought that sounded interesting. It was in the city limits. It's between the Chrysler Jefferson North plant and the Mack Avenue engine plant for Chrysler. It was built in 1919 by Liberty Motor, and it's got a real claim to fame in that in the 50s, it built and assembled the body for the original Ford Thunderbird, one of the iconic cars of Detroit's 20th century. So there's a rich heritage there in that plant, and the fact that it had been there since 1919, and if you see it, it's an absolutely gorgeous administrative building. It's a replica of Independence Hall in Philadelphia. So, I mean, it's iconic in several ways. So it seemed to me that I could use that plant, if I did my job right and if I were allowed access to it, to tell a story about working class decline using that plant as a symbol of that decline. And that was the germ of the idea.
And did you get access to it? I mean, usually those things are kept under pretty tight wraps.
Yeah, I mean, that's a story unto itself, and I tell it quickly in the book so as not to bore the reader, but the obvious question a reader would have is, well, how did you get this access? So very quickly, when I saw the closing announcement, it came, it was in the paper, but along with that was a press release from the company. So I called up the guy who wrote the press release and said, could I meet with you? I would like to work on a book about this closing. And I met with a few people from the company, and they were great, and they said they would cooperate. A couple weeks later, I got a call and said, you know, as much as we like this idea, you know, it was clear that somebody above them didn't like the idea.
Well, I was going to say, usually the idea of a plant moving overseas or just closing period isn't real popular with the kind of image projection a company would want out there.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there's nothing to be gained by having me in there from the point of view of the company, and I realized that. I tried to make clear to them, which is the case, that I was not writing, and I don't think I did write, a sort of muckraking book. I was not looking for corporate dirt or anything. I wanted to tell a very human story about the human cost of a plant closing and what happens after that closing. So in any event, I couldn't get in via the company. So you look for alternative routes. And as I say in the book, Detroit's a big city, and there's always a different way to get somewhere.
How'd you do it?
Well, I when I saw the articles in the local papers, one of them, I think it was the News, asked for memories of the plant. And so I looked at those memories that people had posted, and some of them were extraordinarily moving. You know, my father, my grandfather, four uncles, whatever, worked in the bud plant for decades, going back to the 30s, the 40s. So I wrote down some of those names, and I looked some of those folks up. And the caliber of people I met in researching this book was simply incredible. Everyone very helpful, with the exception of the company. And I got passed through several hands, and a lot of those people are in the book or they're thanked in the book's acknowledgments. And one of the names I was given was the benefit rep for UAW Local 306, which no longer exists, on East Warren Avenue on the east side. And I got in with this fellow who's named Ray Dishman, great guy. And his father and uncle had worked in the plant going back to the 20s, I think his uncle had come up from Tennessee. So a really rich heritage, a great story. And Ray kind of helped me understand what is involved for employees in a plant closing. Ray was the guy who helped people decide, do I take a buyout? Do I take money in lieu of medical insurance or what have you? So that's an early scene in the book. Ray then gave my number to a friend of his after the plant had closed. The announcement was in May 2006 that it would close. December 2006, very early December, the plant did close. So after that, there was about a 3 or 4 month period where I didn't really know what was going on. By the end of April of 2007, about 4 months, 5 months after the closing, a crew got in there that was going to start taking apart the equipment. And a friend of Ray's, who was another ex-Bud employee, whose father had worked at Bud for a number of years, beginning back in the 50s, was working with that crew. And Ray gave my number, passed my number along, and long story short, I got in with that crew.
Punching Out is the book. 1 year in a closing auto plant. We're talking about the closing of the Bud Company auto stamping plant on Detroit's east side with Paul Clemens. When by 2006, if this was, you know, if that company was had a pattern like most of auto, that was older workers, middle aged, that you didn't have a lot of young guys, huh?
That's correct. And by the end, at its peak, 50s or 60s, the plant was employing, I think, it approached 10,000. Never got quite to 10,000. But by the end, there were, you know, it was a skeleton crew. I went through that plant a few days before it closed at the end of November 2006, and they were kind of trying to ship out the final parts and so on. And it was nowhere near, you know, the 9,000 or whatever it had been at its peak. But it's an amazing facility. It's 2 million square feet, and back in the day, they used to call it the Mini Rouge because it did a lot. It made wheels. It made stampings. Like I said, it built and assembled the Ford Thunderbird. It had its own foundry. Really an amazing facility.
Why did it close?
Well, the Bud Company was founded in Philadelphia in 1912, I believe. And this plant was bought by Bud in 1925. It had been built in 1919 by Liberty Motor, which, like a lot of early motor car companies, went bust. It's like any sort of industry with startups. The plant had its glory years, as you sort of laid out at the beginning, during World War II and after. But there was decline. You know, you would have to ask the people at the company what they thought was behind it. I heard various theories, but the company was purchased in the late 70s by Thyssen, German steelmaker, which then merged with Krupp, another German conglomerate.
A couple of companies with a long history in Germany, but we won't go into that.
There's no need to go into that, but that might explain partly why they don't want a writer writing about a closing. But yes, your listeners will know what the history there. But in any event, so ThyssenKrupp, by the end, the plant was called ThyssenKrupp Bud. Mm-hmm. But this is Detroit, and everyone just called it Bud or sure. Buds, as we say around here, putting the apostrophe S.
Yeah, now we're working at Ford's.
Yeah, that's
or
right.
Buds, or Chrysler's.
Or Kmart's. I go shopping at Kmart's. Right, yeah. Sure. Kroger's. So no one called it ThyssenKrupp Bud. It was just Bud.
We should tell people what we're talking about. An apostrophe S isn't the name of the company. It's not Ford's.
Right.
Yes. Okay.
Right.
Paul Clemens, go ahead.
But in any event, it closed. And so the idea that I had, along was what happens then? And, you know, we hear a lot about plant closings, but I felt like I didn't know a lot about plant closings. And I think as a writer, it's always helpful to lead with your own ignorance. There's a sense of discovery as you go along, and hopefully you can convey that to the reader. So what I wanted to know was what happened to the people. And as I described a few moments ago, I talked to quite a few former workers, but then it's hard for me to describe to your listeners very quickly how big a 2 million square foot facility is and how much stuff is in it. And so the question is, where does it go?
Yeah.
Who buys it? What happens to it? And I thought that in telling that story about the afterlife of a plant, so it's closed announcing and its actual closing is sort of almost the preamble to the book. The main story of the book is what happens then. And I thought that what happened was fairly remarkable, and I think it was my privilege to be able to witness as much of it as I did.
Well, there's a part in your book, Paul Clemens, Punching Out, where you drive up to the closed plant in a pickup truck with one of the workers. Could you maybe?
Yeah, that was Ray Dishman. That was right before the closing. And I think we were in his Crown Vic, actually. But that was when I went through the plant days before it closed in early December of 2006. But I repeated that experience a great many times after it had closed. And the story that was sort of the pitch line for the book and the story of the book, if I had to put it in a sentence, is that it's about the American working class mopping up after itself. You have working class fellas, it was all guys by and large, working in a place that had sustained generations of working class Detroiters. But in the absence of productive work, working for one of the big three, putting cars together, I kind of got turned around. They had used a similar skill set to take apart the equipment.
Were the same men involved? Were they
in a couple of cases? Yeah. In the case of Ray, he was not on the cleanup crew, but there was another worker who was. But there were ex-UAW guys who had worked at the Rouge plant, mm-hmm, who came over, and a lot of them were younger guys who, if there had been work in one of the big three plants, would have been doing that. But
is it too strong an image to say it's almost like digging your own mass grave?
That sounds like a bit of hyperbole, but when you go into a place like this and you just see it, it's such a saddening sight.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it almost doesn't sound too exaggerated. It's using the same skill set to take apart the stuff that made stuff rather than making stuff. You know, it seems... I think I phrase it in the book as a wound somehow self-inflicted. You know, you take the same work ethic, the same skill set, and yet you turn it on its head. It's a rather saddening thing to watch.
You know, interestingly, I was without a job when I was in my early 20s and went over to the Bud plant that you talk about in Punching Out, 1 year in a closing auto plant, and saw people going in. They were hiring then, you know, back then. And I thought, I don't think I want to do this, and fell asleep. I went into the back seat of my car, fell asleep. The only time I've ever been dishonest with my wife, I came back home, and she said, any luck? I said, no, they weren't hiring me. But because to me, it was onerous work, and that's why I got into broadcasting instead of doing honest work, like so many other people do. But but what was there, which I didn't realize at the time, that was more than just onerous work. There's a whole culture there, and you talk about going back generations.
Sure. I mean, you get a sense that there's a lot being lost, obviously, and what comes foremost to mind are paychecks and a quality of life. But you also feel, the more you reflect on it and watch it, that we're losing a certain amount of muscle memory, the skill set, again, to do this stuff. you know, it only takes a generation for it to go away, not being passed on from one generation to the next. It's hard to really wrap your head around what we're losing. It's not just monetary. But, you know, what I found in there, and this is another thing I didn't know until I started researching it, was that taking apart industry is its own industry. And so what's documented in the book are the different industries that are involved in it. You have trucking companies that have to take the stuff out. You have rigging companies who move the heavy equipment and get it on the trucks. You have scrap companies who come in and that equipment that didn't sell overseas or wasn't bid on at auction gets cut up into pieces and sold as scrap steel. You have the plant still stands, but in many cases you have demolition companies, you have environmental remediation, you have auction companies who come in and run the auction. That's the meat of the book. What happens after it closes? That all of that's in there. And what I found, I have to note that a lot of this just falls under the category of dumb luck, was just a remarkably diverse cast of people, because in the plant on any given day, I would hear German, Portuguese, Spanish. These are the people who were in there working to take the stuff out. They were from the foreign suppliers that were buying the equipment.
This increasingly is what's called the precarious workforce rather than the permanent workforce and unionized workforce.
Sure, there's no guarantees.
Yeah.
That's right.
And I was astounded that in your book you talk about a trade publication, Plant Closing News. That's
What I wanted to do, maybe I should back up a bit. When I first wanted to write the book, my publisher said, you know, you can't just write about one plant. It's got to be bigger than that. It has to have, you know, write about three plants. And I said, well, you know, I really want to drill down on this one plant. I'm from Detroit. I want to write about a Detroit plant. And so as sort of a compromise, I talk in the beginning of the book, I don't talk. The guy who runs Plant Closing News, a very articulate and humane gentleman, he talks about the sort of national scope of this. Because it's not just auto plants that are closing. It's not just plants in Detroit or Michigan or the upper Midwest. Plants are closing constantly all over this country. It doesn't have to be auto. It can be a textile plant down in the South, anything. And Plant Closing News documents it. And they document it for the people who read the newsletter and buy the newsletter are people in the industries I just said, trucking, demolition, environmental remediation, auctioneering. Because they know when a plant closes, they're business opportunities for them.
Yeah.
It's capitalism on the downside.
Punching Out is the book. It's published by Doubleday. The subtitle is 1 Year in a Closing Auto Plant. It's about Detroit's Bud Company auto stamping plant on the east side. My guest is Paul Clemens, and you can go to his website, find a lot more, including video. You say there's
a video of the book and a lot of pictures.
Yeah, and Clemens is C-L-E-M-E-N-S. So it's paulclemens.com. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E. .com. You know, I think people who aren't in a union, which is the overwhelming majority of people,
sure,
don't understand that there's a sort of a parallel culture besides just the work culture, that outside of work, that the union at union functions, everything from picnics to Labor Day marches, and that people are linked together in a much more integral way than ever those of us who come to work as solitary individuals. And so that always hits union members pretty strongly, because all of a sudden they don't have a job and that culture is gone too.
Yeah, I think the book came out about, 10 or 15 years ago. Was it Robert Putnam, called Bowling Alone? And it was about how the decline of these sort of traditional unions or church groups or whatever, and the decline of the sort of social network that sustains all of us, and how that's been collapsing. But I did want to have a lot of the union history in there.
That is a real social network, folks.
Yes, correct. I'm sorry.
Face-to-face human beings.
Correct.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Correct. But I wanted to fill that in. And so one of the scenes in the book, I travel to California, outside of Oakland, and I talked to Irwin Bauer, a great, great character who worked at the Bud plant in his 90s now, but he was a very strong union member there in the 40s. And, in fact, his roots go back to Ohio and the little steel strike in the late 30s. So I wanted to trace a lot of that history as well. The book, in 240 pages, which sounds like a lot but isn't, tries to cover as much ground as it can. The history of that plant, the union element, and then, you know, where we are now, which is a global world where industry is going to go where labor is cheaper and where it can make a buck.
What do you think? I wonder if you got this out of the men. One of the reasons that companies have gone to other, maybe even the major one, is that, as you just indicated, Paul Clemens, that labor is cheaper. And that's, you know, labor is also called variable capital. In other words, you can get it at different prices, where that's one of the few things that you can either pay a lot for if it's unionized labor, or pay next to nothing for if it's being produced in China or Bangladesh or something like that. So some critics, you know, say that we union members, of which I'm one, have priced ourselves out of the market, and it's the cold hand, neither you know, punishing nor compassionate that's dictated it.
That's the invisible hand, Adam Smith. Yeah.
So if we all would have agreed to work for $4 an hour, the bud plant would probably still be humming.
Sounds like a race to the bottom.
Yeah, it is.
Sure.
And what sort of personal reflection do the men have that made because of the unions, because of the New Deal, were able to elevate themselves into the middle class? How do they view all this?
Well, I'll tell you, that's why the book is an elegy. I mean, the subtitle of the book is One Year in a Closing Auto Plant. My editor said to me when I delivered it, he said, you know, this is kind of a weird book. Huh. And that's not what a writer wants to hear from his editor, first of all. But what he meant by that is this. That if the subtitle had been punching out how corporate greed ruined America, or mm-hmm. punching out how union greed ruined America, or punching out how NAFTA destroyed industry, something with a thesis, it would be a much easier book to pitch. But the book is not prescriptive. The book is descriptive. I'm trying to describe what happens. Now, in that description, you touch on a lot of the things we've been discussing, but the book really just tries to elegize this culture that is unfortunately been taking its knocks as of late. But as a writer, I'll give away the ending to the book. You sometimes worry about something being too on the nose, too good. I mean, sometimes something a little bit tangential works better. But the last scene of the book, the epilogue, I travel to Mexico. I fly to central Mexico, and the Bud plant's largest press line was 16 line, a massive press line that did body stampings for the Ford SUVs, Navigator, Explorer. And a Spanish auto supplier, Gestamp, bought that line for its plant in Aguascalientes, Mexico. And I had befriended the Mexican engineers who were in the plant for months, and they allowed me to go down for a couple days and see that line. Well, when I got down there, what I found out was that line, which again was from a plant that sat between, and still sits, between two Chrysler plants, is now stamping parts, was in November of 2008 when I went down there, stamping parts for the Dodge Journey,
a Chrysler
car.
What were the workers making in an hour?
Nowhere near what a UAW
probably
worker
two
makes.
Bucks. I think that was. Although they took a pay cut recently, actually.
Well, the UAW did. That's another.
No, I mean the Mexican workers.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean the UAW did as well in the last round of negotiations in 2007, I believe that was.
So Paul Clemens, there's really not lesson. There's not a lesson here, is there?
Well, I mean, there's.
It doesn't have to be.
There's a lot of opinion out there, and whatever I can do as a writer. I think is simply to illuminate and describe. People have their opinions on these issues, and I touch on them, but I don't really engage them because it wasn't the objective in this book. What I'm trying to do is just illuminate a process that I hadn't seen illuminated before, which is what happens when a plant closes. Where does all this stuff go? Who buys it? Why do they buy it? How do they get it where it's going? Another press line went to Brazil, so I talked to the truckers who took it down to the dock in Houston and was put on a boat for Sao Paulo. I find all of that detail fascinating. Now, embedded in that narrative, obviously, one can draw some conclusions, but I really don't put my hand on the scale, so to speak.
Where you went, in fact, we're almost out of time, and I know you got to get going, you describe what the area around the Bud plant was and the Jefferson stamping plant and all that. It was what's there now? I mean, all the buildings down, is it just this wasteland?
Well, the Bud plant still stands. It's 2 million square feet, and again, the facade of the plant is just remarkable. If people haven't been by it, it's a replica of Independence Hall in Philadelphia. It looks like something out of Greenfield Village.
Huh.
Not a lot of people see it, though. If you drive along Conner Avenue, the plant does not face Conner Avenue. You can only see it in profile, but it should be a destination for anyone doing a tour of Detroit plants.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the broadcast. The book is Punching Out, 1 Year in a Closing Auto Plant. The author is Paul Clemens. You can go to paulclemens.com. That's C-L-E-M-E-N-S .com. And there'll be a link on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Paul Clemens, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Did you know that life insurance rates are near record lows? If you don't have coverage, listen to this. AccuQuote can help save you up to 70% on a term life policy that's right for you. Pick up the phone and call AccuQuote at 800-654-2075. AccuQuote has helped hundreds of thousands of people save a fortune on their life insurance. Here's how. AccuQuote monitors hundreds of top-rated life insurance products so you can get the lowest rates. For example, a healthy 40-year-old can buy $500,000 of 10-year level term for less than $21 a month. Rates for women are even lower. A short 5-minute call is all it takes. Call AccuQuote for a free life insurance quote at 800-654-2075. Rates, policy forms, and availability vary by state. Find out how much you can save on life insurance. Call AccuQuote for your free quote. 800-654-2075. That's 800-654-2075. If you think of yourself as a technical person and want to pursue a career in technology, get started by calling ITT Technical Institute. At ITT Tech, you can develop knowledge and skills to pursue opportunities in a variety of career fields. Fields like electronics technology, information technology, and drafting and design. Call 800-741-5123. Thousands of graduates have launched new careers after attending the ITT Techs nationwide. Classes and day or evening courses meet at convenient times and teach skills used in the workplace. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career services are available for graduates. Make a technology degree program part of who you are. Call ITT Technical Institute for more information. Call right now. 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123. That's ITT Tech. 800-741-5123.
Is it time for a new roof? If the roof on your house is old, weathered, or in need of help, you can save $500 if you call Sears Roofing right now. Call Sears for a free in-home consultation at 1-877-938-1414. Call right now and you can save $500. Sears licensed, fully insured contractors can get your roofing job done right. Just call 1-877-938-1414. Sears has a variety of shingles and styles that are built for long-lasting performance. And you'll save $500 if you call now. So call 1-877-938-1414. Hurry, offer ends soon. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears authorized licensed contractors. License information available upon request. So call Sears Roofing and save $500. Call 1-877-938-1414. That's 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. You know, this is the 50th anniversary of the week in which Dwight W. Eisenhower, the President of the United States from 1953 to 1961, was made in his final speech, talked about the military-industrial complex. I bet every one of you listening have heard that phrase before, and probably a lot of you know what it means. Some of you may know exactly what it means, but I suspect there's a bit of confusion about what it all means. Everybody knows we have war industries. Detroit was the arsenal of democracy during World War II, and weapons production plays a role in the overall economy and what have you. But let's take a look at actually what Dwight D. Eisenhower meant by all of this. And we're going to bring to our microphones Gareth Porter. He is an investigative journalist and a historian specializing in U.S. national security policy. His most recent book is Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam. And Gareth Porter is at his office in Arlington, Virginia. Welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you, Peter. Glad to be on.
Do you think that's true, that people, it's one of those phrases that almost everyone's heard, but not everyone knows the exact definition of or can't really conjure up what it's entirely all about in an accurate sense?
Well, I think people have a general notion that this has to do with the military and people in the private sector, and that is correct, that what Eisenhower was trying to get at is there was a new power combination that made for a serious threat to American democracy and American liberties. And what he meant by that was that the military services, who were already, you know, extremely powerful, arguably the most powerful institutions in American society, had linked up with the arms industry and the military contractors who were getting the contracts to manufacture missiles and airplanes and tanks and so forth, had become political allies of the military, and together they constituted a new form of political power. Now, what people don't know, I'm sure, is that Eisenhower had originally intended in that speech to include the congressional part of this new sort of political power combine. He was going to refer to it as the congressional military industrial complex. He eventually decided against that, but in a way it's too bad, because it would have further illuminated the nature of that political power that he really did fear in terms of the future of this country. And you know, it's interesting that he began to work on the speech as early as 1958. He had been working on it for more than 2 years. So he cared about this very, very much. And the interesting question is why he, in fact, waited until his farewell address to bring it up.
Well, I want to talk about that for sure. Let's get a little sort of snapshot of President Dwight Eisenhower. Now, here was one of the most distinguished generals of World War II. He had spent his life in the military. So you would think that he wouldn't have any problem with a military-industrial complex, even if it was growing in power. Usually military men, like in any bureaucracy, the more power, the more prestige, the more people, everything that can accrue to a government bureaucracy, the better in the minds of the people.
Well, that's a very interesting point, an important point, and I'm glad that you've raised it, because Eisenhower, of course, as a military hero of World War II, once he retired from the military and entered politics, he then separated himself from the institutional interests of the Army, which, of course, he had been a part of, and became a very different sort of political figure. He was, of course, as president, he had his own political agenda. He had a whole set of issues that he cared about, which transcended the interests of the Army and of the military services more generally.
Well, he ran as a peace candidate in 1952.
He did run as a peace candidate, and I would say even more significantly, throughout his two administrations, Eisenhower was very clearly determined to avoid a new war. He felt very strongly that it would be a disaster for the United States to get into another war, and you know, that war would either be a war against the Soviet Union, which would be the most disastrous thing to have happened to the United States, or it would be a brush fire war on the periphery of the Soviet Union or of China. And in either case, Eisenhower was absolutely dead set against it. He, of course, as I document in a book that I wrote, published a few years ago on the U.S. path to war in Vietnam, Eisenhower was very much opposed to the United States becoming involved militarily in 1954, when the French were suffering defeat at Dien Bien Phu, and some people in the military, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or at least some of them, were pushing for the United States to enter the war, perhaps by dropping a few atom bombs on the Viet Minh troops. Eisenhower absolutely had no intention of allowing that to happen.
Let's be clear about that. Was actually advocated. I mean, this was one.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's so. Right. And so that was really one of the first instances, it wasn't the first, but it was one of the first instances in which Eisenhower rejected the recommendations by the military leadership, by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to either go to war or to threaten to go to war. I mean, there was a time in 1954 when the Joint Chiefs were recommending, calling for an ultimatum to the Soviet Union, saying if the Soviets didn't make the diplomatic concessions to the United States involving Eastern Europe, that that it would be a serious, there would be a serious threat to the regime in the Soviet Union, which clearly implied that the United States would make war on the Soviets.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to emphasize that Eisenhower was indeed determined not to get into a war, and in so doing, he found himself very much at odds with the military leadership on a whole series of issues, including with the, in the case of the U.S. Army, their desire to have more ground forces, to have a larger manpower, and to have the equipment that they would need to be able to intervene on the periphery of the Sino-Soviet bloc. That was a fundamental interest of the Army, and they pushed it very strongly, and Eisenhower simply said no.
Mm-hmm.
He cut their budget severely, cut their manpower below what it had been at the end of the Korean War, and essentially put himself at odds with the Army brass for the remainder of his two terms in office. And so there was a big campaign that the Army waged against him, which I would argue, along with the campaign that the Air Force waged against Eisenhower during his two terms of office, was the real reason why he felt so strongly about this this military-industrial complex, because they had really targeted him for abuse, for attack, both directly and mostly through the news media and through friendly members of Congress.
My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Gareth Porter, and this week marks the 50th anniversary of President Dwight Eisenhower's farewell speech in which he warned of the rise of a military-industrial complex. And Gareth Porter has just written the piece for Counterpunch.org, From Military-Industrial Complex to Permanent War State. And one of the things that you say in it is 50 years after Dwight D. Eisenhower's 1961 speech, pardon me, on January 17th, on the military-industrial complex, that threat has morphed into a far more powerful and sinister force than Eisenhower could have imagined. Now, that's kind of, that phrase, kind of a tough pill for most people to swallow. Even in these days of deficit overrun, there's a little squeak about maybe we could reduce the military budget a little, but I doubt if they will. But sinister, I mean, that's a pretty strong word.
It is strong, and I think that it's absolutely justified by the record of the past decade or so in particular, where you have a series of developments in which the U.S. military and the other national security agencies or institutions of the U.S. executive branch have really obtained new and very far-reaching power to make war in ways that are really beyond the ability of the U.S. Congress and the American people, of course, to be able to control. And I'm referring here to two or three things. One, the CIA's Operations Directorate got the approval from the Bush White House, and this has continued, of course, under Obama, to have very wide discretion, very large degree of freedom to use drone strikes to attack individuals who they suspect are somehow associated with the Taliban, either Afghan or Pakistani Taliban, or the Al-Qaeda people in Pakistan. And this is all happening on the Pakistani side of the border. They have such wide freedom that it's not necessary for them to have really sort of the normal intelligence basis for a decision to use lethal force.
Let alone a congressional declaration of war that's called for in the Constitution. Yeah.
So this is really an unprecedented degree of freedom given to a secret organization essentially to continue to make war. The other thing that has happened, which in a way parallels that, is that the Special Operations Forces, Special Operations Command, in its regional commands made up of task forces of special operations units, has gotten the same kind of freedom of operation to go into countries like Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia and elsewhere. Of course, Afghanistan as well, and in Iran and in Iraq, they are carrying out the night raids or targeted raids against people that they suspect are enemies. And again, these targeted raids, which result very often in killing people, and very often they are innocent civilians, are based on, in many cases, only the most tenuous and very dubious intelligence. So, I mean, this is another case where an institution has been given unprecedented freedom of action.
Well, I was going to say, though, is this really, is this the military-industrial complex, or is this just the extension of executive military power beyond the scope of what had been previously?
Well, I think that you're right to distinguish between what has happened in recent years and the original formulation of the military-industrial complex. This is based on the power that the military and its allies have had for decades now, but it goes well beyond that. It is indeed a new kind of, I would argue, a new kind of state formation in which both military forces, I mean, this really, the Special Operations Forces Command, constitutes de facto a kind of fourth or fifth, if you will, military service. I mean, technically it is not a military service, but the degree of freedom and budget and prestige that has been given during the Bush, George W. Bush and Obama administrations really does make it a de facto additional military service. And so you have really a very new development here in terms of military, the power of a military service or de facto military service to make war without very much regulation or control, or even, you know, being able to know what's going on. And I've written stories about the Special Operations Forces and have pointed out that other agencies, including the CIA, by the way, have been complaining that they cannot get any information about the targeting that Special Operations Forces are carrying out.
Hmm. Well, go ahead,
yeah,
finish.
Same thing is true for the CIA. The CIA targeting for drone strikes is being kept from other agencies of the U.S. government, other intelligence agencies, for example. The military intelligence people are unable to get information about what the basis of the targeting by the CIA is, because it's being done on the fly, as it were. It's not vetted at all. It's not being checked out by disinterested analysts, if you will. It's being, basically the CIA, as is the case of the Special Operations Forces, are basically finding the intelligence or making the intelligence and then using it instantly for operations. And this is a terrible thing to have happen because, you're the judge and executioner at the same time.
Well, let's do that. I've never done this, but I'm going to try a little technique here. I'm going to pretend like this is a phone-in show, and I'm going to call.
Sure.
I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to take a call. Hi, you're on the air with Gareth Porter. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show. Hey, thanks for taking my call. Well, I've just heard what your guest said, but I don't think he realizes this is the 21st century. It's not 20th century positional regular warfare. We're not fighting armies that that are in trenches or something like that. And what our military is attempting to do is to keep us safe. And things, we have to do things on the fly. We can't just be bound by 18th century rules or even 20th century rules. that if we want to keep ourselves safe, we've got to entrust these judgment calls to the people that are on the front lines. And I have to tell you that if a few people get ground up in the process, well, I'd rather it's them than us. Well, how do you answer that call?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is indeed a very common response to the situation that we're facing here. And I think the real problem, there are two problems. One is that I think a caller with that sort of position is failing to recognize a fundamental reality of the 20th and 21st century United States. And that is that whether it's the military-industrial complex or what I call the permanent war state, these military and paramilitary institutions who are entrusted with this kind of power to make war are not disinterested institutions. They're not run by officials who are capable of or willing to separate out their own personal and institutional interests from the interests of the United States and the American people. And what we have seen over and over again, and Eisenhower was the first, I think, the first major political figure to recognize this and to say so, at least to imply so publicly, that these leaders of the military were operating in their own interests. I mean, they had interest in getting as many planes, as many missiles, as many troops, and as big of a budget as they possibly could. And Eisenhower understood that they were perfectly capable of using underhanded tactics. The Air Force, for example, put forward basically fabricated intelligence in order to try to put pressure on Eisenhower, first of all, to manufacture more fighter planes, or more bombers, excuse me, and then secondly, to have an urgent rush program of missile building.
Which is what Kennedy ran on in 1960,
exactly.
Dishonestly.
And my point is that Eisenhower understood that these military figures were acting on the interests of their own institutions and their own personal interests rather than the interests of the American people. And that's really the fundamental problem that we have here in the 21st century as well. You have these organizations who want to have drone strikes. They want to have more and more opportunities for night raids in more and more countries, and they're getting it. The consequences of that are not making us more safe. And I can tell you that I have written one story quoting a figure who has been in touch with people involved in the drone campaign personally, and they're directly involved in the program, and they believe, based on what they have gotten from the CIA itself, that the consequences of the drone strike program have been to strengthen the ability of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda related organizations to recruit in Waziristan, where this program has been carried out. They believe very firmly, very strongly, that the consequence has been to strengthen the support for the Taliban rather than to weaken it. And so, I mean, this is the kind of thing that we face constantly, that the military force that is being applied by these institutions, supposedly to make us safer, is having exactly the opposite effect.
Gareth Porter is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. He's written recently From Military-Industrial Complex to Permanent War State. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of President Eisenhower's farewell speech, where he warned about the rise of a military-industrial complex. Let's talk in just the few minutes we have left about the economic effects of all of this. The conservatives talk about they want these free market, Friedman economics, but they, like everyone else, depends on this Keynesian model, which essentially is the government being this huge supplier of cash into the economy. And we have this situation where $1 trillion a year is transferred from private wealth, those of us that earn it, to the state. The state then disperses it essentially to the military industrial complex. So it really is all, and as you correctly say, it's so we have a permanent war state, but it's a foundation, a fundamental of our economy. I mean, what happens if you pull the struts out from under?
Well, it is a fundamental of our economy. There's no question about that. The real issue, however, is whether, you know, military Keynesianism is an effective form of stimulation of the economy. I mean, the reality is that when you buy missiles and tanks, and they're used up in a war, they don't really contribute in any way to the furtherance of economic growth in the United States. Once, you know, you spent the money, it's a waste. Whereas if it was non-military Keynesianism, if you were investing in transportation infrastructure or bridges and education and so forth, these are investments that have further knock-on effects, which, you know, involve obviously furthering the economic and social development of the United States. So it's not, in fact, Keynesianism in any meaningful sense. That is to say, Keynesianism in the sense that you're really furthering, you're maximizing economic development or economic growth.
It's ineffective Keynesianism. In other words, you would get much more bang for your buck, so to speak. Well, maybe that's a weird analogy.
What is very effective in doing, of course, is buying off members of Congress. By you know, spreading the contracts for the military programs across as many districts of Congress as possible, and they've been very clever about doing that, so that virtually every member of Congress has something in his district that he has to protect, and you know his vote then becomes subject to pressure. Not only from the contractor, but from the workers in his district who get paid by the military contractor, despite the fact that it's not an effective way of promoting economic growth. It works politically to keep the status quo.
And there are some jobs. Not like they produce none. So, yeah, so if you start saying, well, we're going to cut the military budget, which we could and still
right.
make save
by... As the economy falters more and more, when you have a sector of the economy that is continuing to grow, as the military sector has, it's doubled since the end of the last decade, from 1998 to 2008, it more than doubled. So when you have a sector that continues to grow, of course it takes on greater and greater importance in terms of jobs and in terms of the politics of jobs in Congress.
Well, Gareth Porter, at the end, in fact, we're at the end of our interview as well, of your article about this subject, From Military-Industrial Complex to Permanent War State. It's at counterpunch.org, and there'll be a link on my website as well. You say the only thing missing from the picture that you described, where people oppose this kind of spending, is a grassroots political movement organized specifically to demand an end to the permanent warfare state. That's not on the agenda, and there's certainly no congressional political movement towards that. So we're just going to have to suck it up.
Nothing exists at this point that is even remotely close to what is needed to push back against this development. But I want to emphasize, and I tried to do that in my article, that this formation, this new formation that we've seen develop over the last 10 to 20 years particularly, is politically vulnerable. And it's vulnerable because particularly you have a combination of a war which is increasingly very unpopular, that is Afghanistan, which in a way parallels the Vietnam, post-Vietnam situation, where the American people turned against Vietnam so strongly that it then led to strong opposition to high levels of military spending for another 15 years or so.
Let me get you to give the two other ones quickly because we're almost out of time. Sorry.
Yes, so opposition to the war plus opposition to high military spending are now very well documented. And then you have, of course, the issue of the deficit and the necessity to really cut the budget very radically in order to deal with that. And really, you know, that has to involve very deep cuts in the military budget, because that represents 56% at least, perhaps it's more than that now, of discretionary spending in the federal budget.
I want to thank you so much, Gareth Porter. Gareth's first name is spelled G-A-R-E-T-H. Gareth Porter, his articles are easily available through a Google search. His latest, and I think sums up what we just talked about, From Military Industrial Complex to the Permanent War State, is available at counterpunch.org. There'll also be a link on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. This is an issue we need to face. Gareth Porter, thanks for being on my program.
Thanks very much, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Why do we go through so much hassle for our morning coffee? We make it, wait in line for it, fuss with cream and sugar. There has to be a faster and easier way to shake the morning blunts. There is. 5-Hour Energy. It's ready right now. No making, waiting, or fussing required. And it really works. Just open it up, knock it back, you're done in seconds. Now that's fast and easy. 5-Hour Energy. The no-wait, no-hassle way to a great morning. Try it today.
Individual results may vary. See 5hourenergy.com for more details.
How much will your next car repair cost? If you have premium auto protection, there's no worry. You'll never have to pay a car repair bill again. Car repairs are expensive. $3,000 for a new transmission or $4,000 for a new engine can really set you back. But not if you have Premium Auto Protection. They'll cover the cost of your car repairs. You choose the repair shop and Premium Auto Protection pays them directly. You'll never pay a car repair bill again. Premium covers your car, truck, or SUV repairs. And they offer free road service and rental cars. You get top quality service. Satisfaction guaranteed. If your car is less than 10 years old with less than 150,000 miles, call Premium Auto Protection for your free quote. You'll never pay a car repair bill again. Call 866-960-2525. That's 866-960-2525. 866-960-2525.
Time's running out. You're maxed out on your credit cards. The collection calls are coming every day, and now you're two payments behind on your mortgage. Every time you turn on the radio, there's some cheerful couple telling you how they got out of debt overnight. Their stress is gone, and everything's just wonderful. Come on. The truth is, what sounds too good to be true is too good to be true. You need real help, and you need it now. Not bankruptcy. That should be your last choice. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're the attorney-driven program, dedicated to helping you get out of debt in months instead of years, saving you thousands, and without risking your family home. We know what we're doing, and we don't make promises we can't keep. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Get out of debt. Call Credit Card Relief at 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282.
This is your Biotech Minute. Biotechnology, a big word for an area of cutting-edge science that is improving the world we live in. In health, biotech provides breakthrough therapies and treatments for devastating diseases like cancer, MS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and HIV/AIDS. Biotechnology is also helping farmers produce more crops from existing acreage, reducing fuel use and greenhouse gas emissions, and it's creating fuels from renewable green energy sources like algae and plant waste. And this is just the beginning. The biotechnology research being done in laboratories today will improve the health and quality of our lives and our world for generations that follow. Biotechnology, helping heal, fuel, and feed the world. A public service message from this station and the Biotechnology Industry Organization.
It's a message that the aliens are broadcasting throughout the entire universe.
Back to the Rock. On the Riff.
differently.